Good day, everyone, and thank you for joining us for the third and final day of the IMS 13 Technical Education on Enhancements and Migration Planning Teleconference Series. Today's teleconference will include a two-hour morning session followed by a one-hour lunch break, and we will conclude with a two-and-a-half-hour afternoon session. Today's teleconference is being recorded. In today's teleconference, we will cover the following topics: IMS 13 database and DBRC enhancements, and IMS 13 installation and migration. At the end of the day, we will have a 30-minute question and answer session. If time does not allow us to get to your questions, please send it via email to ibms@us.ibm.com. The speakers for today's session are Nancy Stein, Glenn Galler, and Dennis Eichelberger. At this time, I would like to hand the call over to Nancy Stein. Please go ahead.
Good morning, everyone. Let's get started here. We're going to take a look first at the database versioning. And I'm going to jump to slide 4. The version 13, what we're going to do is allow you to have different versions of the same physical database so that applications can actually see and use different versions. All right. So this will be multiple views of the same physical data, and we will require you that you have the IMS catalog in effect and enabled so that we can keep information about the DPD versions inside of the catalog. All right. And the benefit here, of course, is that you can support multiple versions of your IMS databases, and then also that you can change the physical structure of your database and not have to modify every existing application program. Right. You can have older programs still using, say, a base level of a database version, and you can have newer programs using subsequent versions. Right. Let's go to slide 5. The software requirements here will be the same as the requirements for IMS 13. Like I mentioned, you'll need to have the IMS catalog enabled, and you'll have to have a DBRC Recon Min version set to 1.13. So you'll have to have your recon ready to roll with just IMS version 13. These fixes, these enhancements will not be retrofitted back to version 12. All right, and the hardware requirements are the same as version 13 also. Slide 6. For a quick overview for versions, versions going to provide the ability and capability for you to assign different version identifiers to different physical layouts of the IMS database structure. Right, a segment structure in particular. All right, then it will enable the structural changes to the database while these multiple views of your physical data are available to various applications. The applications that reference the new physical database structure will be able to be interconnected and brought online, while your existing applications use previous database versions and keep maintaining their existence and their processing. Right? Applications that don't require sensitivity to any of the new physical structures, like I mentioned, can just continue on with no modifications and no recompilation of any programs. The whole database versioning enhancement works very well hand-in-hand with what we'll talk about next, which is the IMS 13 database alter feature. Slide 7. The databases that database versioning will support, the database types are DDBs, HDAM, IDAM, PHDAM, and PIDAM. The kinds of structure changes that we'll support, as I mentioned, they're structure changes to segments. It is not a structure change to the database hierarchy. It is not a structure change to mainly the hierarchy. I cannot move segments from under one parent to another parent. I can only change the actual structure of a physical segment. Right? But for all of these database types that we're going to support, you can increase the length of a segment, and you can add new fields to any undefined space and at the end of the segment. Now, for full function in HowDB, so this does not apply to DDB, but for full functionality types, you can add new fields that redefine and provide an alternative mapping to existing fields. There's a major caveat here. You must make sure that the database, the character types that you're redefining in the database, maintain that character type. I can't have a field that alpha characters and then try to redefine that, remap it with a binary numeric field. Right? So be very careful if you consider doing remapping. Right? Let's go to the next slide. Slide 8. Right? Now, before database versioning gets established for the database, IMS will continue to recognize only that current database definition, the current physical structure, the current DBD. All right? But now with versioning, I can put a version number, I can use a version number in an incremental incremental numbering pattern, and I can specify that on a specific DBD. Right? Now what we'll do is we'll allow your application then to specify which version do you want to use. Right? And we've got four different ways to do this that we'll get into. There's the system default setting. You say here's the overall database level to use if there's no other level specified. There's a PSD setting for a database level. There is a specific setting for a version on a PCB within a PSD. And there's a programmatic VLI and if call that you can use to set the version for a specific runtime environment. All right, so let's take a look at each one of these. We'll take a look at each one. So on slide 9, continuing on the versioning overview, like I mentioned at the get-go, we require that the IMS catalog be enabled. The catalog is where we're going to store or where we store DBD definitions. And if you remember, if you've heard any presentations about the catalog, we store multiple instances of DBDs and PSPs in the catalog. All right, so with versioning, that fits very well. Each version will have an instance of the DBD in the catalog. All right? So obviously the catalog has to be populated. So you would take your ACB lib and initially populate the catalog. All right? All of your IMS data sharing systems, like I mentioned, have to be running IMS 13. This is only supported with IMS 13. Hence, we're going to require the DBRC min version be 13.1. I think I said 1.13 before, but it's 13.1. All right, I'm going to go to slide 10. Now, the way you implement this, I said there's four different ways that you can identify the version that you want to use. In the system DFS DF proclib member, we have a new keyword, database. There's a new database section. And there's a parameter called DB version. All right? That DB version, new keyword that says enable versioning. Then there's a DB level parameter, new keyword, that indicates, you're going to indicate to us the default database version to be used within this IMS system. Right? On the DBD macro for the DBD gen input, you can specify a DB VER, a database version. And you'll give us a database version number. Also, on the PCB macro, in the PSB gen input, you can specify a DBVer, and again, give us the database version number that you want to use for this specific PCB. All right? On the PSB gen, we now have a PSB gen statement. In the PSB gen input, we've added a DB level parameter that will override the DB level parameter that you specify in the DFS DF proclib member. And lastly, we have altered the init version, the init call, the DL1 init call, and we've added a version parameter. So within a program, you can actually execute a DLI init call and set the version for a specific DBD that you want to use. That init version call, the version used in the init version call will override every other setting of the version. Right? So it'll override if you have a setting on the PCB, it'll override the DB level you have on the PSB gen statement, and override the DF proclib member. Okay. Just a couple of points about the init call. You have to specify that before you would issue any DL1 calls to that specific database for which you want to set the version. All right. Let's go to slide 11. All right, so let's take a closer look at the DFSCF hotline number. This DB version, where you enable versioning, you either say Y or N. No is the default. All right, so if you put version 13 up and you take defaults on the DFSDF database member, database section, database version will not be enabled. All right? There's the DB level parameter, and there are two values for this parameter. You either say CURR, which represents current, or you say BASE, which represents base. Now, of course, if you have database version equals N, not enabled, then even if you code a DB level, we just ignore it. Now, if you specify current, which is the default, what IMS will do by default, if you set no version anywhere else, we will return database information using the current DBD version. That means the most recent DBD instance in the catalog. All right? And that will match the physical instance of the segment. Right? So unless you specify a version in one of these other places, that's the version that's going to be set as the default once versioning is enabled for the entire IMS subsystem. Now, if you say base, B-A-S-E, IMS is going to return data from your databases with the lowest DBD version that's stored in the catalog, right? And again, unless you specify that version in one of the other places, right, on the PCB, in the DLI init call, on the PSB gen statement DB level, you are going to get the base version if you code DB version equals base in DF proclad number. Right, let's go to slide 12. And here's just a representation here of the format of the database section for the DFSDF proclad member for the version, for the DB version. You can say, you say yes or no. No is the default. And then you say comma DB level, current or base. Current is the default. So as a sample here, I've got a database section. And I say CB in 64-bit equals 8. And I say DB version equals paren. Y, comma DB level equals base, close paren. And at that point, I've enabled database versioning, and I've set the DB level to be base. All right. Here's a second. Okay, let's go to slide 13. Now, I said we added a new parameter to the DBD macro statement in the DBD gen input, and the new parameter is DBVer. This is where you're going to tell us that this version of the DBD, that this instance of the DBD is going to have this version name, this version number, all right? So this version is associated with a certain structure of the database segments. Right? Again, we support access DDBs, HDM, IDAM, PHDM, PHIDAM. The numeric values for that version can be anywhere from 1 up to 2 gigs. Right? And there's the sample layout of the DBD macro and the DBD gen input. So you see we've added DBVer equals at the end. All right, let's go to slide 14. Okay, the DBD is where I specify the version that this DBD representation is this version. Now on the PCB statement, on a specific PCB, I can say I want to use this DB version. All right, so use the same parameter, DBVer, and you're going to use similar nomenclature for the value there, to say, here's the version I want to use when this PSB is accessing this database. Now, the version number has to match a DVD stored in the catalog, right? Like I mentioned, these instances of the DVD with their version number are in the catalog, so it has to be there. Otherwise, if you try to use it, you're going to get a failure. And then if multiple PCBs in the PSB use that same database, each PSB in that PSB must use the same database version. I can't mix and match database versions within one run unit. Okay? Now, the values here can be from 0 to 2 gigs because 0 is a default version in the catalog when you first create an instance of a DVD. That is version 0, right? So you can actually use the 0 version, right? And if not specified, again, then we're going to roll up through this hierarchy. The DV version used is going to depend on, do I have a DV level statement on the PSB gen statement in the PSB? If so, I'll use that. If not, what do I have set for the DFSDF Proc Live member database section DV level value? All right, let's go to the next slide, 15. All right, and let's just take a quick look at the PSB gen statement where we can specify DV level. And you'll notice there's two values here. You can say CURR or you can say base. And they mean, have the exact same meaning as what cur and base mean on the DB level parameter and the DFSDF proc log number. Right? Only this will override the overall system default that's in the DFSDF proc log number. Okay? So again, just to restate it one more time, if I use CURR, that says give me the current highest version of with the physical implementation of this database structure. And if I say base, it says give me the lowest version that the catalog knows about. So I've got some previous base version image view of the segments. All right, let's go to slide 16. Now, I mentioned that you can use a new DLI init call, and it's an init version call. Right? So your program now, even though all these other settings for version are set on the PCB, on the PSB gen statement, on the DFSDF proc live member, you can individually override that in the application so that this run of this application at this point in time is going to use a specific version. Right? And again, I have to specify a version number in this call that matches a version number for the DVD that's stored in the catalog, right? But this is going to take precedence over every other specification for the version, right? And then again, like I mentioned before, the init call, if you're going to use the init for a version to set a database version, it must be exited prior to your first DO1 call to a specific database. Right? Don't do it before the get unique to the IOPCB, but do it before you would do any database calls to that particular database. All right, and you can only issue one init version per DBD, all right, for a specific database. You can have multiple init version calls going to different databases. And I'll show you can also string all your databases together in a long parameter in one init call. But if you like doing separate calls, that's fine. You can make those each separate interface to IMS, but you can only do it once for one database. You can only set the version in a runtime unit one time. So let's go to the next slide, 17. All right, and when you do this init version call, you're going to send us an IO area. All right, and here's the format. It just says version, paren, and then you can string together the DBD name, equals, give us a version number, comma, DVD name, version number, and so on. Well, like I mentioned, if you prefer, you can do multiple init calls for each one of those databases. I don't know why you would want to do that, but if you wanted to, you could do that. All right? Again, you cannot make a second init version call to the same database. Right? So don't specify duplicates in this string of date of DVDs and versions. Right, and make sure it's an actual version that exists in the catalog. Otherwise, you'll see that you're going to get some stat codes back. You're going to get some bad call returns. All right, I'm going to go to slide 18. And here's a couple of the new status codes. There's a BE now that can come back on the init call, the init version call. And that just says that the database name that you have on the version function for the init can't be found. All right? So correct your database name. Right? You got a typo probably. There's a BG stat code, the database type of the database that you used in the version function. is not supported. So maybe you slip the GSAM in there. Maybe you slip the logical database in there. They're not supported. Let's go to slide 19. There's a BF stack code that says the init version call is invalid. And there's different reasons why, it may be invalid. Maybe it's not a version number for the specified database, right? You can't find it in the catalog. It's not within the supported range of values. Maybe you had a typo there. Maybe it's different from a version number specified on a previous init version call. Remember, you can't do that, right? And so, check your code. Fix up your working storage I/O area. Make sure what you're moving into that area is a proper database name, and it is really the one you're looking for, right? And then lastly, too, you better make sure that your system programmer has enabled versioning. Maybe you thought that they had turned versioning on a test system, and you tried putting the init version call into a test program, and it didn't work. Guess what? The sysproc didn't enable it in the DFSDF proc line member. Right, so you might have to coordinate with your sysproc, or maybe even your DBA. Go to slide 20. There's a few other status codes also now that come back on the init call. You can take a closer look at some of those. There's different reasons why the values that you're passing to the init version call are invalid. Slide 21. So for database version determination, if database versioning is enabled in that DF proclive member, right? The database version that we're going to use to actually give you a view of the IMS data, the one we're going to return to your program in the I/O area, if all you have set is the DF proc live member, then depending on what you have in the DB level parameter, cur or base, that will determine which version we give you, what representation of the segments we return to your call or calls. Then on top of that, if you have the PSB gen statement, right, in your PSB gen input and you specify DB level, if that is different than what's in the DFSDF default, or not default, but in the DB level in the DFSDF proc line member, it will override. So again, you have current or base. Then I can go one level up, be more specific, and I can say for this PCB within my PSB, I want this particular DB version. And so you use the DB ver parameter. And then last but not least, the thing that overrides everything is the DLI init version call. Right? So that takes precedence over all the other settings, all the other places where you can set the version for a database. Right? Let's go to slide 22. I'm going to walk through an example here. In this case, I've got a database where I've got a customer information file, database, and I've got a customer account segment. Right? So you can see I've got account number, member name, balance, credit limit. And in this case, my system has versioning enabled, but it's not the default of CUR. It's at DB level equals base. That's what's set in the DF proclog number. So unless I override that in one of the other mechanisms that I have, I'm going to use the base version of all of my segments. So in this case, I'm going to use the base version of the customer account segment. The segment is fixed length. All right. Variable length segments do not work well with versioning because we can't tell where fields are, right? It's variable length. So this segment is a fixed length segment. And it happens to be that there's no more space for any additional fields, yet I had a requirement from my user community to add a rewards field. All right? I'm going to go to the next slide, 23. All right? So the DBA has to add this rewards points to the database. But we have so many programs that would have to change to make use of this expanded segment, right, a bigger I/O area, that, maybe that would take you months and months to be able to get this rewards point in. Well, with versioning, we can do it pretty quickly. I'm going to add rewards points, so I'm going to create a new version of that account segment inside of the DBD for the SIF database. And so I'll expand the length of the segment. I'll add the new field called rewards points in the expanded space at the end of the segment. And I'm going to put a DB version on this DBD, and I'm going to call it 201401. Right? Now, you're going to want to have some kind of governance and some thought behind what you choose to name your versions. And, you know, you've got up to 2 gigs worth of numbers. So I think, it makes sense to somehow relate that DB version to a release number, so long as the numbers are increasing, right? But maybe you can use a year, month, day, or year, month kind of nomenclature for your DB version naming. And that's what I chose to do here. I said, this is the first new version, aside from the base version, it's the first new version for 2014, right? So I don't have to touch any of the existing applications. The DBA can go ahead and make this DBD change, right? Existing applications don't know about the new field, nor are they going to see it or update it, all right? So let's go to the next page. Now, I've got an application scheduled. Okay, and let me interject here. At this point, the DBA would have taken the database offline, unloaded it, implemented the new DBD, right, gen the new DBD, put it in place, and reloaded the database, right? So now the database physically has the rewards points field at the end of this segment, right, the customer account segment, right? But I said I'm not changing any of these other programs, right? So here we go. Versioning's enabled. I've got a version of 201.401 for my SIF database, and I've also got a base version. They're both stored in the catalog. And I've got a program that comes through, and it's going to use the base version of the database. All right? That's what I have set as the system default. These are existing applications that don't have to make a change to anything. They're going to use the base version. When they read that SIF account, their SIF database customer account segment, and they want to update, in this case, the program wanted to update the balance because somebody just made a big purchase. So they do a replace call. So we see the segment the way it existed before, account number, member name, balance, credit limit. Remember, this existing application doesn't see rewards points, but it's on there, physically it's on the database. And now we're going to replace the balance. The only I/O area this program knows about are those first 4 fields. And I'm going to update the balance field and do a replace. The rewards points, whatever value is in there, remains unchanged, untouched. Remember, this program does not even know about that rewards points field. Okay? Let's go to the next slide, 25. Now, in this case, I've got an application program that I just coded up, or maybe I modified an existing one, and it's going to know about the rewards points because it's going to maintain the rewards points value for me. So it's going to use version 201.401 of the DBD. So it'll start reading the customer account segment, and it sees all 5 fields in the I/O area. It updates the balance because there was a $50,000 debit done here, right, some sort of a purchase. And I'm going to give them another 50,000 rewards points. Okay. Now when I do the replace call, the entire segment, all 5 of those fields are in the I/O area, the entire segment gets replaced, right? And, of course, any other fields that I don't change are left unchanged, right? That's how IMS works, right? We read it, pull it in an I/O area, change the fields that we want, and replace it back, right? So you can see I can have some programs using version X, or base in this case, that know nothing about new fields that have been added. And I can have other programs using the most current version, and in this case 201.401, knowing about the entire segment, the new physical instance of the segment. Okay? Let's go to slide 26. Now, when a program reads the database version that's not currently active, not the currently active physical version of the database structure, what we'll do is we go to the catalog and we get information for the version that it's looking for. And in this case, it would be the base version, right? Or not the current version. Wouldn't have to be base, but it's not the current version. So we're going to go to the catalog and get the DBD information about that version of the database segments, all right? Then we'll compare the catalog information with the DBD for that DVD to the currently active DVD information, right? And we'll determine some differences. We'll build some tables internally so we know, oh, you're using version base. Here's how big the segment is. Oh, you're using version 201.401. Here's how big the segment is, all right? So when database version is enabled and you don't request a version, by default, you're going to retrieve the data at the current physical level. I think that's how IMS works today. There's one physical level of it, one physical version of a segment, right, in the database, and that's what you get. So unless the DFS DFXXX DB level parameter is set, right, if you don't have that set, you're getting the current version. Remember, current is the default. Right? If that's not what you want, you got to make sure then that the sysprog sets that DB level to base. And there's been discussion about this. Some people want it, want the default to be base, right? So that if a program or a PCB doesn't say what level and you default back to the DFS DFPROC DB level, some people say it ought to be base. Other people say, no, I want it to be current because I want everybody to come current. Well, you can get into some discussion there on that. I in particular think that when you start, you want to set your DB level to base. Remember, if you set it to current and there's a change, all of your programs have to change. And if that's the methodology you want to work, you know, the implementation methodology where all programs have to change when a database segment changes, that's fine. But if you want to be able to take advantage of not having to change all your programs when you add a new field, I think you want the DFPROCLAB member default to be base. Right? Just, that's an opinion there. You have to figure out for your shop what works best. And I'm going to go to slide 27. I've got a couple samples here just to show you the flow of what happens here. So I'm going to start with a system that has no versioning in it, right? And just look at, you know, what's the process flow here? Well, I started with, some DVDs that I had genned and some PSBs that I had genned, and I created some ACB live members, right? I mean, this is how our systems look today, right? I've taken database definitions, program definitions, gen them into ACBs. If I've got a catalog, which, of course, for versioning you need to have, I've got a catalog, and when I gen my ACB member, I also create and insert into the catalog the new DVD and PSB definitions, right, the new instances, right? So, and without versioning, all the versions in the catalog, really, they're zero, all right? Because, you know, you don't have versioning at this point. So really, under the covers, we actually consider those instances version zero. So the most current one would be your version zero. That's the one you're going to get the most current one when you do a call to IMS today without versioning and using the catalog. Right? So the active versions of these three DVDs, they don't contain any DBVer numbers. Database versioning is not enabled. The application then comes through the yellow box down in the bottom left corner. The application comes through and does calls to these databases, right? And the IMS data that's returned to the application is exactly what's in the physical, the current physical structure of the segments, right? So if I'm looking for a specific segment in the DBJK21, I get exactly what the physical instance is in that database, right, for the particular segment I'm looking for. All right, and you notice the control blocks loaded inside of IMS there, you know, at the number 3. They're the active ones that came from the ACB line, right? And we only have one. We have one ACB line member, and that's the one we use, right? Let's go to the next slide, 28. Let's take a look here where I enabled versioning, and I've set the DFPROCLAB DB level to CUR, right, Brian? Maybe I don't set it, but that's the default that I get if I don't set it, right? So the DB levels occur. So now I'm going to make some changes to my DVD source, and I'm going to call them all version 1. Right? They all say DBVer equal 1. I gen those out to the DVD lab. I pull up my PSB gen for a particular application. I pull up the input. And what I'm going to do for the DBJK21 PCB is I'm going to say use version 0, I don't want to use version. I don't want the current version. I know I've changed it, but I still have to use the old version here. DPJK22, I'm not going to specify, so guess what? Takes a default, right? It's going to fall through and use the current version, unless I would specify it with an init version call. And then on the DBJK23, I'm going to specify this is the one I want to use the new database structure. So I run my DVD gen, PSB gen, run the ACB gen. I've got the catalog enabled. When I run the new ACB gen, I create not just the ACB number, but now I also create the instance of the DVDs and the PSB in the catalog marked as version 1. Right? So version 1, the ACB Live members, version 1 of the ACB Live members for the DVDs are put into the ACB Live in the catalog. All right? Then I come down and my program, well, let's say in the active IMS system, when somebody uses those ACBs, that's what's loaded into the control blocks in the system itself. Now I have an application program that comes through and wants to make calls for different segments on these three different databases. So I invoke the DLI interface. When it comes through, when I'm looking for DBJK21 database, the PCB said use version 0. Well, what's loaded into the IMS internal control blocks? I've got version 1. So what we have to do is we have to go look at the catalog, retrieve the information from the catalog for that DVD, right? Now we know with this program's version, what their view, another version, so we know what the view should be of the segments that we return. And the same for 22, call comes through, the PCB then specifies, so we fall through and we take the DB level default, which was per. And we're going to use version 1. Well, that matches the control blocks that are loaded, so we're fine there. We use the current physical implementation of the segments. That's the view that 22 calls to database 22 are going to get back. And then the same with database 23, although we specified that one on the PSB gen, the specific PCB for that database. So it will get the physical implementation of the segments for database 23 are what will be returned to the application program. Let's go to the next slide, 29. In this case, I've set the DB level is still at the default at cur, but now what I've done is I've changed the DVDs and I've got version 2 of each one, and I've changed that PSB gen again. And in this case, I said, I'm going to set the DB level equals base because JK22 at version 1 or version 2 is not what I want. I want that at base. So, again, we run the gens. We populate the ACB Live member. We populate the DVD and PSD instances in a catalog for version 2. Inside the running system, we've got the current implementation of the active ACB. Right? ACB only has one member. It's the current. It represents the current implementation of the database. Right? So we have all version 2 for those three databases. The program comes through and says, give me got a call for JK21, and I need version 1. So, again, we're going to go up to the catalog, retrieve the information, return the segments with the view that version 1 has of that database's segments, right? When we look at JK22's call, we say, nothing specified on the PCB, but the PSB has a DB level of base. I need to return version 0 information, the version 0 view of the database segments. What's loaded in the system is version 2, so I must have to go to the catalog, get the version 0 representation, and return that view of the database segments back to the program. And the same when I make calls to JK23, look at it and say, the PCB is a set, that's the version to version 2, and we look at version 2, that's exactly what's been loaded in the active system. So it matches the running ACB line number, use the information there, and return the current physical view of the segments for that database. All right? And then one more example, just to show that, again, change the DVD, leave the PSB the way it was on the last go round, right? But now what I'm going to do is I'm going to use the init version call in my program. Okay. And so I code a storage area that has version, parens, you know, dbjk21 equals 3, dbjk22 equals 2, and dbjk23 equals 1, meaning on jk21 I want version 3's view, on jk22 I want version 2's view, and on jk23 I want version 1's view. And so again, when I do the calls to different segments for those databases, I'm going to look at that version. So on 21, I need version 3. That's the current version, so I can use the control block information that maps to the current physical structure and return the segments. On 22, I need version 2, so I have to go to the catalog, retrieve the information for version 2, and you'll get a view of the segment that matches for version 2. And then for 23, I need version 1. Again, I'm going to look at the catalog. I know how to map the segments for version 1, and that's the view of the segments I'm going to return for the calls to JK23. All right? Go to the next slide, 31. All right, we've enhanced the query command, the type 2 query database command. There's now a show version option. All right, and if you do this type 2 command, we'll return the version number of the database that is currently active in the online IMS system. So that means it's the version that's represented by the ACB live number. Okay, hang on 1 second. Hang on here. Okay, and what we're going to return there is that for HowDB master, if in the name you give us the HowDB master database name, we're going to show you the version for the master and we'll show you each partition. If you give us a partition name, the HowDB partition name, the response will only show that requested partition. Right? Now I'll tell you, the partitions and the master all have the same version. Okay? It's just two different formats in the display. But for FastPath DDB, the response will only show the DDB information. Right? You cannot specify this version option with any other show filters. The version stands on its own. That's just the way it's designed. So you can query database, name such and such, show version. Right? And now slide 32. The output, there's a short label format and a long label format. And, you know, then just a little description there of the different parameters. Obviously, it's the version number and the completion code, and then if there's any error text. All right, so let's go to the next slide. I've got just a little display on the output. Here's the top output is the short using short labels, and the bottom is using the long labels for the output. And you can see that you get information, these are all using long labels. I'm sorry about that. But what I've got is like a successful show version and then one that has errors. All right, so with the errors, we add the CC text, the condition code text, inside there between the condition code and the type. All right, so just to give you a sample of what you will see on the output. Let's go to the next slide, RACF. I strongly recommend, you know, use the standard RACF definitions that you use to secure IMS commands and secure the query. You know, it's fine if you want people to be able to execute that in the development system. And then you have to make decisions, you know, who can look at it, who can do the commands in the production system. Right, so make sure you secure it. All right, on slide 35, you can get a user 3303 ABN. Of course, first you'll get the DFS 3303I message. Then you'll get the 3303 ABN if you don't use the init status group A function, right? In status group A, you can suppress the ABN and get a status code BA returned instead of the ABN. But if you do get this, that says that the DLI call for a specific version of the database failed, right? So if database versioning isn't enabled, you're going to get the 3303, right? If it is enabled, maybe you have an invalid database version number specified somewhere. maybe the version can't be found in the catalog. If it's a valid version number, but it's not in the catalog, it's not one of your valid version numbers. Or maybe the current database structure has some kind of a change that you made that's not supported by versioning. All right. And then there could also be a storage area where we don't have enough storage to build our internal blocks of information to satisfy a request for a version other than the current. Remember I said we have to go to the catalog, we have to get the information, we build some internal tables. Possibly there's not enough space for us to do that. All right, I'm going to go to the next slide. There's also a new error, a DFS 3549E, that says, you know, you attempted to access a prior version of your database, but we can't build the internal control blocks required, right, that required for a prior version, one that doesn't match your current ACB live member. And probably the latest version of the database change has some sort of a definition change that's not supported by versioning. Maybe you changed the exit routine. Maybe you changed the number of segments. Remember I said the structural change we support is changing a segment. We can't change the structural format of the hierarchy. All right, so maybe you thought you could add more segments. No, you can't do that. Maybe you changed the insert or delete rules. Maybe you changed the segment code. Can't do that. You know, maybe any of these types of errors, and we'll kick those out with the 3549E. All right, a couple different formats of the message itself. All right, the next slide. Just again, you see some of the enhanced message text there for the 3303i and the 3549EZ. That's kind of an eye chart there. And then also on page 38, there's some additional versioning error messages that you can get, including things like, you know, the DVD messages and the PCB messages, the PCB is a PGEN message, where the gens themselves fail, right? So the value on the DBVer operand is not valid in your DVD statement in the DVD gen input, right? Or maybe it's not valid on your PCB statement in the PSB gen input, right? So we'll catch those kinds of things also. So there's some new error messages there, right? Then go to the next slide, 39. Now, how do you, you know, what would you do to migrate? What kinds of things do you have to think about as you're going to start, you know, looking at versioning? Well, the very first thing is you have to populate the catalog, right? You have to use, you have to enable it, and you have to be using the IMS catalog. And like I said, that's where we're going to store the different version information in different instances of the DVD, all right? So enable the catalog, populate it, all right? If you don't do that, all we can know about is the current physical implementation of a database that matches the current ACB member. Right? That's all we can do without having the without having versioning enabled and without having the catalog enabled. Right? And remember, all your systems, if you're in an IMS Plex, if you're in data sharing, queue sharing, they must be running IMS 13. Right? And even if it's a one-way system, your DBRC min version has to be 13.1, right? So once you get database versioning enabled, then you have to decide, what am I going to specify this new DB level parameter? Do I use the default, which is cur, DB level equals cur, you know, inside of the DFS DF proc live members, that all the applications then will get the latest, the most current physical database version, or do I set it to base? That says all the applications by default will access the database at the oldest, lowest database level in the catalog. You have to make a decision on that, right? So your shop, you're going to need to be talking among your applications people, your DBAs, and your system programmers. Right? and if you don't use, or if even though you enable the versioning and you use the DB level and you decide what you want that set at, remember, people can set the PSB gen DB level parameter, and they can also set the PCB DB version parameter inside the PSB, right? So that if the application needs to use something different than the system default, they can choose to do that.
The application programs can also choose to use the de-alignment version call. Right? And I consider that, I'm not going to say you're never going to need it. I can see where people may make use of the de-alignment version. It's what I call dynamic version switching. Right? I'll give you a quick example. You may have an application that does certain things based on certain years. For instance, maybe a tax application. Maybe you're a government agency. And you may use the same programs, but you have a little bit different twist on information that you have to store in the database from year to year. You know, and you keep building on your segments as maybe you have a new field that needs to be added to the segment. Well, you could dynamically, as a transaction came into your IMS system, you could look at some year indicator and you could actually say, you know, do the init version using this year, and that's the version of the database view that you would get. And if it's the next year, you know, maybe it's 2012, maybe it's 2013, maybe it's 2014. That's where I see that coming in handy if you have something like that. You know, something that you could make use of where being able to dynamically use different views of the database would be really helpful to you. And I'm sure you probably think of other ways you can use it too, but I think that we'll see less use of that than we will see use on, I think, PCB statements in a PSB gen. Right, let's go to the next slide. So in summary, version 13 allows your applications at the same time to use different versions of the same physical database, that have different views of that physical database. Right? And those views are maintained in the catalog DVD instances. Right? And each DVD can have a version number on it, as you saw. Right? So the programs can all use different views of that same physical database. And what this does is it allows you to support multiple versions of the databases at the same time, not having to modify all of your existing application programs when one of those database segments changes. I can make the change, and only the programs that need the new information would have to change to use the new, more current version of the data, of the DVD. All right? So next, I'm going to move into any questions, anything quick that anybody has?
Okay, and it would be star one if you would like to ask a question or make a comment. Once again, star one. And we have a question from David Meissen of Hewlett Packard.
Yeah, I just was wondering what page you were on.
Oh, I'm sorry. The last page I was on was 40.
Okay, thanks.
All right.
Mr. Meissen, is there anything further?
No, that's it.
And it appears there are no further questions at this time.
Okay. I think we're right on track here, so let's move on to the HowDB alter. I'm on page 41. I'm moving to 42. All right. Now, remember, with versioning, I said even though the DBD has changed, the DBA is still going to have to take that database offline, unload it, implement the new DBD, right, reload the database with that new DBD. Right? And at that point, everybody, not everybody, but people now can use this new version. Existing programs can come back online and they can keep using the old versions. Well, what we wanted to do was to make something a little more dynamic for you to be able to change the database on the fly in concert with your versioning, right? You're doing this versioning, you really don't want to have to take a big outage to do this unload and reload. So with HowDB Alter, and you notice it's HowDB Alter, it's not all databases. This is specifically for HowDB. We can make those structural changes to the HowDB database without a major database outage. We do have to DBR the database and bring it back. And you probably want to take an image copy in there too. Right? You can snap a copy real quick. But there's no database outage where you have to DBR the database, unload it, change the DBD, reload it. Right? We're going to do this, let you do it under the covers. Right, so structural changes will be able to be made to the segment definitions. Online reorg is what we're going to use to apply those structural changes to the online HowDB database and all the partitions in that database. And then, of course, you have to use some online change process so that you can activate the new ACB Live member or members if you're doing multiple. Because, again, we have to say this is the current ACB that we're all working off, because this is the ACB that matches the physical implementation of the database. So, again, we can eliminate, really, a large database outage when you have to make structural changes to a database. Right? And, again, the structural changes are only the things that only the structural type changes that we support for versioning. So you can't add segments, you can't rearrange segments in the hierarchy, you can't add a whole new path. It's just segment changes at this point in time. Right? So again, we hope to improve the availability of the HowDB online databases, which we've been working on since version 7. Alright? Let's go to slide 43. And again, for the HowDB alter, it's the exact same requirements as the versioning. It's, you know, uses the same requirements as version, all of version 13. You need the common service layer. The structure call interface and the operations manager are required. You will need to have your DBRC min version set to 13.1, and the hardware requirements are the same as IMS 13 too. All right, so let's go to slide 44. So these structural changes that can be made to the HowDB databases, only structural changes to the segments, it's only THDAM and THIDAM, only the HowDB databases. Right? You can add a new field to space at the end of an existing segment. You can define new fields to remap fields and space in an existing segment. Again, the caveat here is be very careful of character type. Right? I can't have character type of alphas and remap it to all numerics. Somebody's going to hit an OC7 at some point in time if you try to do that. But if it's all character information and I'm just remapping the fields maybe for a different type description and I want to call it something different, maybe I want to split it into two fields instead of one, you could do that. And then increase the length of an existing segment. All right? So let's take a look at this further. Let's go to 45. Just a few kind of tedious examples here, but just to show you. If I'm going to add a new field to space at the end of a segment, okay, here's my base, example 1A. I've got a base segment, field 1, 2, and some space at the end. I still have space in this segment. But I'm going to remap this thing, and I'm going to use versioning, and I'm going to use the alter, because I want to use that space. And, yeah, I could define this new field in the copybook, and everybody would be fat, dumb, and happy. But you know what? It wouldn't be in the catalog. That new field, that new information for the DVD would not be there, right? So you want to get into a mode here where you're using the catalog so that any of your clients using universal drivers have all of the information. It's not just stored in those copybooks, right? You want everybody to know what this segment has in it and what it is, all right? So that would be a reason why you would do that. Example 2A, again, I've got space. I just wanted to show that the new field can be anywhere. It could be in the middle of that space field. All right? Let's go to slide 46. All right? If I wanted to remap some fields, existing fields are in the space at the end. Again, example 1B, I've got a segment that still has some space at the end. Maybe I'm going to remap that whole thing. I'm going to take field 2 and split it into two fields. Either they're all numeric or maybe they're all character. I'm going to take field 3 and I'm going to make a new field, 3A, and I'm going to use that space for field 4. All right, and the same example 2. I can remap example 2B, I'm sorry. I can remap field 2, make it some new field called field 2A, and I could actually rearrange that space in that field 3 at the end of a segment. All right? And then slide 47, I can increase the length of any existing segment. I just add some amount of space on the end. I change the bytes equal in the DBD definition, and I just make the segment bigger. Right? So slide 48, just sort of a summary. You know, there's my original segment. I can add space into the new fields into that space at the end of the segment. I can redefine some fields, so long as I'm careful of how I remap it, and I can increase the segment by adding space at the end of a field. Right? I'm going to go to slide 49. So after you make changes to the DVD segment definitions, I mentioned you're going to need to use online reorg. That's what we're going to use to alter the online database and change it from the current structure to the new structure that you've given us in the new DVD. You do not have to do an database unload or reload, not required, because you're going to use the online reorg under the covers. Now, it does require a type 2 initiate online reorg. You know, those of you that are using HALDB online reorg know that you can do a slash initiate online reorg. This will, the initiate on, slash initiate online reorg will not work for the alter function, right? We're adding a new function to the online reorg, and it is not going to be supported with the type 1 slash command. So you will have to use the type 2 initiate online reorg, which says you got to have the CSL set up, right? You've got to have the structural call interface and the operations manager. You know, we've been pounding on this at user groups and you know, presentations at Share and at IOD, and we've been saying, please get the common service layer set up. It's in a very, very important part of the base infrastructure for IMS. So if you haven't done anything else yet, get the common service layer tasks, SCI and OM at least, set up and running, okay? So we'll only support the type 2 initiate. And then you're going to need to do an online change because you've changed the ACB, and we've got to infect that ACB, right? So we need to make that, you know, the current, the active ACB member that's going to be used in the online system. And if we're going to do all this online and dynamically. Now, what we'll recommend is you probably only want to do a member online change. There's no reason to do a full online change and change everything that you've got in a staging ACB live. So you probably would want to use a member online change specifically for the members that you're altering, right? And once you do this, once you've done that online change, the online reorg's done, the online change is in place, IMS now knows about that new ACB. We know about the new physical structure of this database. Any application programs that need that new information in the database can actually start running and using it. All right? Let's go to slide 50. So just to go over this again, kind of, you know, the prep work that it's going to take, you're going to modify your DVD source code. Right? Define any new fields in space at the end of the segments. Right? You're going to do that by adding new field statements. Define new fields to remap existing fields in space in the segments. You can use new field statements there. And then increase the length of the segment if that's all you're going to do, or when you, if you want to do that, put a new length field in, change your bytes equal parameter on the SIGIN macro. Right? You've got to run the DVD gen. Right? Use the modified DVD source code that you just created with the new physical structure. Run your PSB gen, right? Now, you might need in the PSB gen, you might need to say PCB equals this new version, right? Because you're going to put a version on this DVD. Right? So now I'm going to change the PSBs for the programs that I'm going to use, the new segment layouts. And I'm going to say, for these PCBs, use this version, or on the PSB gen statement, I could say DB level equal cur, use the current, right? And this is, again, I'm working from a base that says you've set the DB level default in DFS DF ProcLive member to base. If you took the default and it set it cur, then everybody's going to get current. As soon as you implement that ACB, everybody's going to get the current view, and that may not be what you want. All right, so that's why I say think about that base default level in the DF ProcLive member. All right, so modify any of your PSBs that need to be modified for the version. Run your ACB gen. You know, you're going to create one new member in the staging library. You're also going to create members in the catalog. And then start modifying in between here. You know, your application folks can be modifying their code for any, you know, maybe writing new application programs or modifying application programs that are going to be able to use these new fields that you just defined. Let's go to slide 51. And just to make a point, you've got to have an ACB staging library, right? So if you're not familiar with that, you'll need to create an MVS dynamic allocation member for a staging library so that you can add the staged ACB member, right, in place so that when you do the online change, you're going to take it from the staging into your real active ACB Live, right, ACB Live A or B. All right? So next slide. Just some other prep work that you might want to do. From a DBRC standpoint, you might want to do a change part, a change partition, and you might need to set some attributes for the partition before it gets altered. You may want to alter the block of the CI size, for example. All right? Or if you do a change part and set it, an alter size, you can say set, you know, do a no alter size. Give the keyword no alter size. It'll clear the block of CI size out of the partition data set. Right? Again, the sizes can't be changed if the HALDB is currently undergoing online reorg. Right? You would have to wait till after the alter operation is completed, and the online change is performed if you, decided you were going to change them again. You can't do it while it's running is the point. All right? But you can set it up so that when the online reorg runs, you can change that block of CI size. All right? Next slide, 53. Again, this is just a little more detail on the alter size. Alter size and no alter size are mutually exclusive, right? They're optional keywords with the change.part command. But the alter size lets you specify new SIM block sizes or VCM CI sizes for those output data sets when the online reorg takes place. And you can specify up to 10 values, one value that matches each data set group defined in the DBD. If you omit a value, you just omit it with a comma, and it remains unchanged. The size remains unchanged for that partition, or for that data set group. I'm sorry, for that data set group. And again, numeric values have to be even and no greater than 32K. And when you do that, the new sizes get stored in the recon partition record, right? And you do this, again, before you start the initiate online reorg, all right? Then the new sizes are stored in the in that recon record until the alter is completed and until the online change is actually performed and the ACB Live put in, the new ACB Live member put into effect. All right. And then after the online change is performed, your new OCM block sizes saved in the OCM block size field of the recon partition and the VCM are not stored in there. The VCM are in the catalog. All right, so just in case you're interested in changing, if you think about it, if I make the segments larger, it might make sense that I change the block or the CI size when I do this online reorg. Okay? That's what this is all about. That's why this is in here. All right, the next slide, 54, the no alter size, it clears the alter size values from the recon partition record. So if you're setting it up and you it's not the size that you want, you decide you need something else, change it. Do a no alter size and, maybe you don't want to change it. Do no alter size and take it out. Or take it out and later on come back and do an alter size. But you've got some flexibility there at least. All right, slide 55. All right, the alter online process. All right, so it's the online reorg, which we built back, for HALDB and implemented in version 9. The online reorg that will actually alter the structure for the HALDB database, the structure of the statements of the HALDB databases. All the database partitions are included. If you're familiar with the current online reorg for a HALDB, the base online reorg, you can reorg partitions individually. With this online reorg, with this special alter feature, you have to reorg the entire database. If you think about it, it makes sense. You wouldn't do anything but reorg the whole database, okay? And what we're going to do is we're going to read the current DBD version from the active ACB Live. We'll read the new DBD from the staging ACB Live, right? And then under the covers, if we need, we'll actually have 10 different TCBs running simultaneously to do the actual alter. Right. Now, while this is going on, application programs that access the existing database with the current version of the DBD, they can keep running. They don't even know that anything's going on. They run fat, dumb, and happy. We build internal tables that represent the changes between the two DVDs, right, on the active input side and the stage from the stage in ACB Live on the output side. All right. I'm going to go to the next slide, 56. And here's the format of the Initiate Online Reorg. So again, only a Type 2 command. Give us the HowDB master database name, and there's a new option, Alter. All right. Those of you familiar with HowDB and Online Alter right now know that you can do an Initiate Online Reorg name, whether it be the master or whether it be a partition. Again, this in this case with the option alter, it must be the master database. Okay, go to slide 57. So you issue the Type 2 Initiate Online Reorg command. We're going to start the dynamic structural changes that are going to happen to this to the HowDB partitions. Again, only one master HowDB database can be specified for an init command. We're going to read the new DVD definition from the staging ACB Live. Like that staging ACB Live is dynamically allocated, so you've got an MDA member for it. The member information is used to construct the online reorg output data set. So as we're reading from the input, we know what the output's going to look like based on this using the new DVD, right? Using the DVD information from the new member in the staging ACB Live. And then output data sets for all the HowDB partitions get built. The Type 2 term, the terminate online reorg, or the Type 1 / term command is allowed. You can hold it up, right? And then the initiate online reorg optional with the option alter command will restart the alter. You can't use the Type 1 command to restart it. Remember, the Type 1 command does not know about the alter function. The term is fine. The / term command will work, but the / init will not start it back up. All right? And when we start back up, we'll pick up where we left off. Remember, just like online reorg, we know where the cursor is. We keep the cursor information where we are through the database on the reorg, so we can start this back up. All right, the next slide, 58. When the application programs that are accessing the altered database, or for the ones that they're going to access this altered database, not until online change is completed, right? IMS is going to continue reading the database using the unaltered DVD and return unaltered segments. You're going to get what's active in the IMS system, which is the old view or the existing view. So until you do the online change, you don't want to implement any of your applications that have been modified to use new fields. They won't get the new fields. Right? We may have the reorg finished. That's fine. The reorg's done, so we've got data in both the input side and we've got data in the output side. But we've not, we're using the output side of this reorg, but we don't let anybody know about that because that ACB Live member that's active in the system doesn't know about this new DVD. All right. So what you have to do is you have to stop access to the altered HowDB database. Right. So use a Type 2 or Type 1 DBR command. Use the update with the stop option or use the DBR command. Do not use the quies. Right. Do not use the update start quies. You only want to use the update with the stop or the DBR command. And then at that point, issue your online change command so that you can, in effect, that new changed ACB Live member or members, and then what all you're changing it at one fell swoop, right? And then I would recommend member online change, even if you have several of them that you're in effecting, I would use the member online change. You know, if you get two or three of them, still use member online change. Right? And then member online change reads directly from that staging ACB Live. And it can process specific ACB members. If you're not familiar with that, I think it was in version 12 where we introduced the member online change. And there's the format. You say initiate online change, type ACB member, and then name, you give us the ACB member names. All right, so even though you've got the online reorg completed, we know everything's reading from the output data sets. Yeah, the input data sets are still sitting there, right? the output data sets, that's what everybody's using. The cursor says I'm done on Unreal. It's finished. We still only have the current ACB control blocks in the system. Okay? So you need to do an online change to get that in effective. Right, let's go to the next slide, 59. And then start your access to the altered HowDB databases. And now you can start implementing your new programs because the new structure is there. And again, so long as they specify the proper database version, they're going to be able to get the new, the new structure of the segments. All right? Let's go to slide 60. Just got a little sample here, example. In this case, I've got a master database, and I've updated the DBD source for it. I've increased the size of segment B, and I changed the bytes equal from 30 bytes to 40 bytes. I run my DBD gen, and I set up the ACB gen in the staging library, particular staging library. I change a few programs. I create maybe another new program to use the new fields that I've added. I'm going to change partition size because I'm going to alter the block or CI size, if it's OSAM or VSAM, because I know I'm adding enough space here that I'm going to mess up how the segments will fit into blocks. So I'm going to change the block size too. So I'll set that up ahead of time. And then I'm going to start and issue the init online reorg name master option alter. And IMS is going to allocate that staging library. It'll build the input DMV control blocks using the active ACB live that's in the system. It'll build output DMV control blocks using the staging ACB live. All right, so I've got the active, the old DMB, if I want to look at it that way, over here on the right-hand side. And there's the input data sets that HowDB is currently using, right? HowDB is currently using the A2J and the X data sets. And over on the left-hand side of the little IMS box, I've got the staging library that has the new DMB control box, and I've got the output data sets, right? So IMS allocates the output data sets. I'm going to make sure I have a backup of the active ACB live members affected by the changes. I probably even want to take an image copy. I'm going to make sure that I've got, all the artifacts that I need to be able to back this out if I would have to. But I'm going to stop the master database access, perform the online change, right? Because I've done the online reorg, everything's finished. Perform the online change, start the master database, and now I can implement my new application programs. And everything's running off of the output data sets, M through V and Y, and is using the new control blocks. All right, the new ACB control blocks. Page down to page 60. All right, and then when we're building the input and the output control blocks, we're comparing the fields in the segments. All right, and we're understanding what's the difference between what was there and what this new one is. So in a simplified format, we've got a little delta table that tells us here's the segment, and on the input side it's 30 bytes, and on the output side it's 40 bytes. All right, so when the alter's in progress, the application program reads the master database here, and in this example it's looking for a segment, a B-type segment with a key 1, all right? So the segment is before the online, if it's before the online reorg cursor, we're going to read the segment B from the output data set, right? And that segment's size is 40 bytes. But we're going to check it and check the delta table. We know your program's using the old version. Right? And so we know that we're not going to return all 40 bytes to you. Based on that table, we're only going to return 30 bytes to your I/O area in your program. Right? So remember, we've got a cursor. Online reorg works with a cursor that we keep track of where we are in reorging the database. Right? And if we're reading for the cursor, that means we've got to read from the output data sets. If we're reading after the cursor, we're reading from the input data sets. But makes no matter. I mean, it does make a matter whether it's reorged or not, but for size-wise, we're always going to look at that delta table and know which version you get, right, and return to you in your I/O area the proper amount of bytes, right? And again, just to make the point, until all the alter and the online change are complete, IMS Regis segment using the old DMB, the existing DMB, and returns unaltered segments, right? So even if I've done the alter and it's finished, if the online change isn't finished, all you're going to see are the old DMB, the old segment layouts, all right? I'm going to go to slide 62. So you might wonder what happens to those fields that I've added. Do they get initialized? What's stored in those segments? What's stored in those pieces of the segments? Well, for fields that are added at the end of a segment, if the DBD field definition says it's a type hex, we're going to fill it with hex 00. If the DBD field definition type says P packed, right, we're going to fill the low order byte with a zero, hex 0 Charlie, and all the other bytes with hex 00. And if the type is C for character, we're going to fill it with 40 spaces. All right. And when if there's no field definitions added on the segment in the DBD, we'll fill it with hex 00. So just so you know, as we're reordering this thing, right, those are the kind of values that will be filled in to the additional space that we're adding if you add space at the end of the segment. All right, let's go to slide 63. Again, just to mention, all the systems have to be running min version for DBRC of 13.1. We only support the type 2 init online reorg option alter, right, for option alter. So you need a common service layer. You need the SCI structure call interface and the OM, the operations manager. The type 1 / init online reorg is not supported. The term is supported for both type 2 and type 1, but not the initiate. Online reorg processing is done for all the partitions in a HALDB master database. You cannot do one partition at a time. Think about it. If you're going to alter the structure of segments and in effect this, we need to alter every segment in that database, no matter what partition it's in. Member online change is recommended to bring specific ACB Lib members online. Yeah, sure, you can do all of them. You can in effect the entire staging ACB Lib, but I think member online change will help you make this process go a lot faster. And then I think you can probably see how mixing the HALDB alter along with changing the database with the database versioning makes for a way to implement changes without impacting all of your existing running programs. Okay. So I'm going to go to slide 64. There is an enhanced query online reorg command. I'm going to go over some of these operational type things. There's new OLR return and reason codes and completion codes for alter. There's a new SF stat code. There are new DFS and DSP messages. There are change DFS messages, you know, all to represent the changes that are made here with the alter. And then several new DBRC commands and some modified list output that I'll show you. Some things that are changed just to show you what's happening with the alter or that an alter has been done. So let's go to slide 65. So the HALDB type 2 query command that you can see where the alter is. You can actually query it and check on the processing. And you say query OL reorg and give us the HALDB master name. And then you can ask for a specific status. Right? You can say give me all of them tell me if it's alter. Tell me if the alter is done, and tell me if the alter is in progress. You would do that if you had multiple HALDB database reorgs going. You can actually say name star, and you can use a generic HALDB name, and we'll show you all the different partitions and where they stand with their status. No, I don't. That's good. I think I have an example, but I do not have an example here. But anyway, that's how you can check on your online reorg alter. All right. There, slide 66. There are some new return reason codes, completion codes. Of course, the zero return code zero says the alter, you know, the online reorg alter completed successfully. Hex 10 says another online RAIR alter is in progress. So, of course, you can't run two of them on the same database. And then there are different completion codes. Yeah, I completed successfully. Made more of the ITAS creations failed. Incorrect HowDB version detected. All sorts of different completion codes that you can get there. And like I put a note in there, there's many more in between. There's a very large list of different new completion codes all related to the online reorg alter function. Right, so just be aware of that. Let's go to slide 67. There's a new SF status code. Now, if you have programs that have field-level sensitivity and they try to read a database segment that was altered in length with the alter function, with the, you know, init online reorg alter, until you actually, in effect, the new ACB member for the altered database, the altered segments can't be accessed by application programs. All right, so any that have field-level sensitivity, you'll have to be aware of. Just know that. And if you try to, read the database, you're going to get an SF stat code if the reorg is in process. Let's see, next slide 68. These are some of the changes to some of the DBRCD output from the list commands. So if you do the list for a HowDB master database, we've got new information there that'll show you. You see down at the bottom right-hand corner some new fields. It'll show you the alter count, and it'll show you how many are completed. All right, so it says I've got four partitions that I have to alter, and two of them are completed. All right, so again, you can use the query command that I mentioned earlier here, you know, the query online reorg. Or you can go into DBRC and do these list commands too. And you'll see about where you are in the, where IMS is in the alter processing. All right. Slide 69. If you say list the HowDB database partitions, what we've got there are in the middle at the bottom, that middle column at the bottom, we have partition values that say, is the alter in progress? And has the partition been altered? So in this case, neither one of these fields are set because this partition that I was looking at, the alter was not in progress, and the partition had not been altered. So there's fields there that you can look at. Then also over on the left-hand column, if I made a block size or a CI size change, for OSAM in particular, I will see the OSAM block size at the top is the current block size, and then I'm going to see an altered block size. If it says 0, it says the block size wasn't changed. And if you see B says 8192, obviously that's a change from 4096. When that alter is done, those new block sizes for OSAM are stored in the recon record there. All right. Next slide, 70. This is just the DBRC list command output, just a big long list of it. It's kind of an eye check chart, but you can see the OSAM block size information is there, and that's only there while the alter is running. And then you see the flags from the partition. All right, so that's from the previous slide, from slide 69 to slide 70. 70 is just showing you the continuous run on of information. Right. On the previous slide, I kind of split it up so it fit and it was larger that you could read it. Okay, slide 71. For the list, if you want to look at the reorg record, previously there would never be, you wouldn't see this blue, or not blue, but the alter that is in blue there on the right-hand side. Before version 13, there was nothing in there. Right, so now with version 13 for HowDB reorg records, if it has been altered, you'll actually see the alter flag. The alter flag is set, so we mark it as alter in the list output. All right. Let's see, slide 71. Know that the DBRC API query output has some differences, and again, it has to do with the same types of things that you saw in those list displays. right? The HowDB partition output block, we now have the array of the block and the CI sizes used by online reorg, right? So that'll exist if the online reorg is in process. The HowDB output block, there's two new counters, the total number of partitions being altered and the number of partitions for which the alter process is completed, the ones that are finished. You're going to have two new counters in that DSPA PQHB control block. All right. And then the same for the database dataset reorg output block. There's that new flag that says whether or not the online reorg has altered the HowDB. So just be aware if you use the DBRC API that there are some new fields on those query requests. All right. On slide 72, the same, some of the recon records. The database record has no size increase. The partition record, the size increases only when the alter is running because that's where we've got the block and CI change information. And then we've also got information about whether the partition's done or not. And whether it's in progress. And then the reorg record, there's no size increase either. There was room for that alter flag. So if you use any of those control blocks, if you have homegrown interfaces that you've written to DBRC, remember you may have to reassemble your programs to pick up these new control blocks. All right, let's go to slide 74. These are commands that we use under the covers to set flags, but it is possible that at some point in time you might get into a situation where level 2 may ask you to do these type of commands. So you can actually do a change database and say alter or no alter. When we start altering, obviously we do a change database and set it to alter, okay? You know, you may need, if you get into a bind with some strange conditions, you may have level 2 or someone at SVL ask you to change those things. The same with the notify reorg. You know, we've got that alter flag, and it specifies that the OLR is altered, or that OLR is altering the database, all right? But again, you're not normally going to use these. I just wanted you to know that that's what we're doing under the covers when you start this online reorg alter function, right? And that you might be called upon to make use of those down the road by the support system. All right, slide 75. Again, this I think is much more important than some of the queries. It's really important to secure this init online reorg command. And hopefully, if you're already using HowDB Online Reorg, you already have the init online reorg command secured so that not just anybody can type a command through a Spock panel and start an online reorg, especially for the alter. All right, so make sure that that is protected, whether you use RACF or ACF2 or Top Secret. Be sure it's secured. All right, slide 76. Right, so some performance considerations. Reorganizing the HowDB using that option alter, it should be very close to the same as just doing your normal base HowDB online reorg. Right, so if you're a HowDB user already and you're using online reorg, if you throw an alter into the mix, it really shouldn't be that much longer. We're copying records from one set of the HowDB data sets into the output side of the HowDB data set. So the performance, the elapsed time should be very close to the regular online reorg time. Okay. Now, changing block sizes might add a little bit of overhead there, but I don't think you're going to notice too much of a change. And remember, you're doing the online reorg kind of with the alter under the covers. It doesn't take effect until you in effect the ACB member change. So, I think it's going to be non-noticeable that way. All right, slide 77. Just in summary then, with version 13, you've now got the ability to make structural changes to HowDB databases dynamically without a database outage. Remember, I said you do need to DBR the database so that you can make that ACB change, right? You've got to do the infecting of the ACB. But if you set that up in an automated rule, I think you can do that very quickly, including even getting an image copy if you want to take a flash copy real quick. But then, you know, now you've got this advantage of being able to change the database segments and do it dynamically on the fly, not impacting programs that don't care about what you're changing in the database. That's the really nice thing, all right? So eliminate the database outage when you have to make structural changes to segments in a database DBD. So we hope that we can improve the availability of the online databases by allowing you to do this. All right. And I may have rushed a little bit here. I know we're ahead of time. Are there any questions about Alter?
And as a reminder, that is star one if you would like to ask a question or make a comment. And it appears there are no questions at this time.
Okay, very good. And no questions. Anybody have anything about versioning? One more chance.
And once again, that is star one to ask a question. Tony Gulart, CSC.
Hi. I was just wondering, on the versioning, if you want to put everything back in sync and get rid of all your versions and go back to a base, how does the cleanup and the catalog and all that take place?
For the catalog, you can actually delete instances of catalog members. Now, what you want to be careful is if you do catalog cleanup, you want to really do some scans and checks and make sure that nobody is using the versions you're going to take out. All right? There's
right,
also a link. Go ahead.
I was assuming that, again, to get a change in quickly, you're using the versionings, but you may want to go back as time allows and bring everything, you know, old programs back up to the new spec.
Yeah, you're kind of breaking up, but I think I understood what you said, that, you know, that even after you do an alter, or you do versioning, do an alter, put it all in place, that you might want to go back and clean up old versions and make, like, require that applications come up to the current level. Did I hear
correct
you right? Yeah, I mean, if your shop chooses to do that, that's fine. I can imagine that there will be shops that may never get rid of some old versions. There are shops that we've heard of that don't have source code for programs, right? So they would probably always want to stay at that base version. You know, so I think that's going to be up to each shop to make a decision, you know. You know, do you make everybody come current? Like I said, there are some people that have told me they want the default to be current because they want the people that are going to lag behind to have to put the version on their PCBs. Now, I don't know if that's a smart thing or not. It's, you know, if you do that, you got to make sure you've got all those old programs covered, right? All the old PSBs for those old programs have to be, you know, putting in either a base version or an older version. I mean, I can see a shop saying, we're going to clean up. Everybody, you know, recompile and retest. Use the new include members. Right? I don't know if that, did that help at all? Did I answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay. One other point that on the catalog, you can limit the number of instances that you store in a catalog. But again, then you have to be careful because as I add, let's say I say I want five versions. As I add the sixth version, the oldest version rolls off. All right? So if I do that, I may impact some programs that aren't ready for that second oldest version, right? The one that becomes the oldest version. I may mess up an application that way, right? You can also say that you only want to retain versions for so many days. So I think this, you know, there's a lot of governance that has to be thought out around both versioning and alter. right? You need to think this through before you, you know, play with it and figure out what kind of rules you're going to set, what kind of parameters you want to set, and then run it through a test. You know, give it a really good test when you go through different release changes before you implement it in production. Anything else?
Was there anything further, Tony?
Nope, all set.
And once again, that is star one to ask a question or make a comment. We'll hear next from Susanna Fernandez of IBM.
Okay, yeah. Perhaps it's a summary to see if I understood this new concept of versioning. For example, I build up a new DVD, new version. It's a vision, a logical vision of database. Logical vision. If I build a new application to work on that new version, right? But, for example, it modifies a new segment, details of a segment, right? It never updates the base, or it's a new database. I'm trying to understand it.
Okay, when you... See if I cut your question here. You're wondering how can you implement the new version and keep a base version? Is that what you're thinking?
No. The version is a logical view because it's not updating the physical database, or is it?
That's correct.
Okay.
It's just a view. Remember that we only have one database, right? The customer database is the customer database. So the segments in there have to be physically implemented at the largest size that anybody has specified, right? So whatever the last specification was, you know, maybe my segment is now 150 bytes long, okay? And there's only one instance of every one of those segments, and they're all 150 bytes long. But I have an old program that says use the base, so I'm going to use the oldest version from the catalog. That's what IMS is going to give you the view of, right? And it may only be 100 bytes long. So when I do that call into IMS, I'm only going to get 100 bytes back. Okay?
Okay. We are cheating.
Physically, the buffer's got 150 bytes in it, but I only see 100 bytes in my I/O area.
Okay. So perhaps it's a basic question, but just want to get it right.
Say that again. It's what? I lost you, maybe.
No, just it was a statement. I just wanted to get it right, you know, because it's a basic concept.
Yeah.
That's it, you know. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Okay.
There's only one physical database. It has the current implementation of each segment, right? But then logically, inside IMS, we give you different views of it based on which DVD version you ask for.
I disagree with you with the base, only not getting the current on the base, because at least the shops where I've worked for only always try are very conservative and they have applications that they have been running for 20 years or 25 years, and so
yes.
They wouldn't want to change all of them at all.
Yeah, so you agree with me that you think you would set your DB level in the DF Proc Live member to equal base.
Of course.
You agree?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I would
yes.
too. The more I've thought about it and talked with people, I think we'll see most people will set that to base.
Yes.
It only makes sense.
Yes.
It makes sense because then all of my old stuff can just keep running, and the people or the programs that need the new stuff they can go make the change to use the new version. You know? And when everything, when the DBA gets everything in place and the database is altered and everything's ready to go, they can then turn on their programs, right? They can load their programs into, you know, existing production program lives, whatever, and they can actually start using them then. Whereas I'd have to do that with all my old programs. I'd have to go change every one of them to open up at least the PSB to set the PCB version I wanted, right? I may not have to touch the program, but I'd have to touch every PSB. So I don't think you want to test. Okay. I don't think you want to retest all that stuff, right?
No. No, not at all. Well, that's it. And we're upgrading in shops right now. I mean, we're upgrading to IMS version 13 now.
Good.
And with the prerequisites, and in 2015 we're upgrading it. So I would like to present these new enhancements for the customers and to allure perhaps to their developers.
Excellent.
I don't know.
Do you have HowDB databases in place? Use HowDB?
What is the question?
No. I was just curious if you use, for the shops you work with, do you use HowDB databases?
No, unfortunately not.
Okay, so you can still do versioning, like I said, but you'll have to still take an unload and then change the DVD and do the reload.
Yep. Yeah.
Thank you. You're welcome. One comment that I just would like to make after she reminded me about upgrading to version 13. Version 11 goes out of support October 20th. It's end of support October 20th this year. So hopefully you all have plans to, if you're still in version 11, to get yourself upgraded to version 13 here shortly. So that's just a commercial for IMS. And that's it, operator, unless anybody has anything else.
There are no further questions at this time.
Right, and then I guess do we still stay on the lunch schedule? So we'll resume at 1:30?
Yes, if you are ready for lunch, I will go ahead and place music back on the line, and we will resume back at 12:30 Central Time.
Very good.
Good day, everyone, and welcome back to Fast Path Enhancements conference call. Again, today's call is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Glenn Galler. Please go ahead.
All right. Thank you. So welcome back. We are going to continue with the database and DBRC enhancements. I'm starting on page 78, which is Fast Path Enhancements. So if you go to page 79, the two enhancements that we're going to talk about now are DEDB alter and secondary index enhancements. So you can go to page 80. We'll start with DEDB alter, page 81. So DEDB alter was developed to allow us to make changes to FastPath DEDB DVDs without having to take the system down. You just heard from Nancy Stein about HALDB alter, and you also heard about database versioning. And DEDB alter works with the database versioning, and it's similar to HALDB alter, but it's done slightly differently. But the purpose is the same, to be able to change DVDs online and possibly use versioning to reference different DVDs. So you can use DEDB alter to change the UOW parameter, the size parameter, the root parameter, and the randomizer name. And we'll talk about how that's done. Unlike HALDB alter, which uses online reorg, HALDB online reorg, the DEDB alter uses a new utility called the DEDB alter utility to make the changes. All right, you don't need DRD to make these changes. The process is done without that. And we do support VSO areas, but you first have to unload them and then use the DEDB alter utility. Okay, page 80 and then page 81. Oh, sorry. I'm on the wrong page here. All right, page 82. All right, so there is a new utility. It's called the DEDB Alter Utility, and it has two functions. The first one is alter area, okay, and that's the function that allows us to make these changes to the DBD. And then the second one is replace RAND, REPL RAND, and that allows us to make a change to the randomizer name. You'll notice that the alter area has a way of changing the randomizer name, and that's if you're changing the randomizer as when you're making the changes to the DBD PARMs, you would use the alter area. But there's some customers that requested the ability to change the randomizer name back after they make the changes to the DBD, and so they came up with a new function called replace RAND, and that simply changes the randomizer name to something else. So it gives you the ability to change the randomizer name back to what it used to be prior to the alter area. Page 83. So there's two functions for alter area I just mentioned. We have alter area, and then you specify an area name, so you can modify the active DEDB area and those parameters or the randomizer. And as I just said, you can modify the randomizer name, RM name, back. The gens that are required in order to make these changes, you need to, after you change the definitions of your DBD, you of course have to do a DBD gen. And after you do that, you have to identify which applications or PSBs reference that DBD, and then you would do another ACB gen for the new DBD and the new and the PSBs that reference it. All right. After you do ACB gen, those new members are placed into the ACB Live staging data set. All right. Unlike HALDB Alter, where you can use member online change or you can do a regular online change, in DEDB Alter, the member online change is driven within the process. So you don't actually explicitly do it. It's driven by IMS FastPath. Okay, page 84. So since member online change is being used, the staging ACB Live, a library, needs to be able to be dynamically allocated. And to do this, you need a DFS MDA member for the ACB Live staging library. It's quite possible you've already done this, but I'm just mentioning it to make sure it is required. So here's some JCL that you can use for dynamic allocation for the member, the staging ACB Live. And there's also a new data sharing group for DEDB Alter, and you would define that in the FastPath section of the DFS DF Proc Live member, and it's called Alter Group. All right, so that's required if you're using communications between data sharing partners that are using the DEDB Alter command. All right, page 85. So IMS FastPath, now that since it's going to be dynamically allocating the ACB Live in order to do this member online change, has to understand how you're using and how you've defined your ACB Live. For instance, it has to know, are you sharing it? If you have, and this is for a data sharing environment that has one or more, two or more data sharing members. Are you sharing it across all the members? In which case, you would define it as ACB share equals yes. Or does each member in the data sharing environment have its own ACB Live, in which case you would define that as ACB share equals no or N. So if you're using the common service layer, okay, CSL. CSL would be, in this case, SCI and OM. So if you're using SCI and OM, okay, so that's called CSL, then we would look for that parameter ACB share equals yes or no in the FastPath section of the DFS DF Proc Lite member. I said that backwards. If you're not using CSL, then we would look for it in the FastPath section of the DFS DF Proc Lite member. If you are using CSL, in other words, SCI address space and OM address space, then we would use this first, second, third level precedence or priority where we would look for the ACB share definition. So we would first look in the DFSCG product line number. That's been around for a long time. If we don't see it there, we would look for it in the common section equals common service layer, that's CSL, of the DFSGF product line number. And the third place we could find it would be in looking at section equals fast path in the DFSDF product line number. Whatever the parameter is, the DDB alter where it's being executed is going to be, it's being executed on a local system, and that's where we're going to look for the parameter setting. Okay, page 86. So the HALDB alter, if you recall what Nancy talked about, used online reorg, and so it had a, it used other data sets. We're copying from one set of data sets for the databases to another set of data sets. That's how online reorg works. So the DDB alter utility is somewhat similar to that in that we need to have a separate set of data sets where we're going to copy the data from the active sets to the shadow area data sets. So this extra set of data sets are called the shadow area data sets. Okay. So these are what are used for migrating the data from the active area data sets. So with FastPath, you can have what's called SADS, or a single area data set, a one-to-one relationship between the active and the shadow. Or you can have MADS, which are multiple area data sets. So you would have multiple copies of the area data set, and you would copy to each of them. And you can have up to 2 to 7 of these MADS. So depending if how you define them, your SADS, if you started with an active data set and only one data set, but you defined 2 to 7 multiple area data sets, then your SAD, when you make this migration, becomes a MADS. Okay? And if you define it the other way, so that you started with 2 to 7 active data sets, but you only defined a single area data set, then your MADS could become a SADS after the DDB alter. All right. So these shadow area data sets are only used for the DDB alter utility, and they're only used for the purpose of migrating existing data. So you're not going to use these for any other purpose. Now, at the same time that you're doing your alter and you're copying data from your active data sets to your shadow data sets, you can also define shadow image copy data sets, okay? And what that means is you can create an image copy at the same time that you're doing your alter, all right? So we'll talk more about the image copy later. Okay, move to page 87. So once you've defined your shadow area data sets, then you have to register them to DBRC. And the way you do that is with an init ADS, okay, init area data set. So you would say init area data set, you put the shadow name, you put the shadow data set name, the area, the DBD, and so on. And you would say whether it's available or unavailable, whether it's a shadow image, is it for the purposes of being the shadow data set, or is it the purposes of being a shadow image copy? So you register it to DBRC. Page 88. Once it's registered to DBRC, then you have to format it, okay? You format the shadow area data sets using the existing utility called the DBFUMIN0. Okay, that's the format utility. That's an existing utility, but we had to change it in order for it to be able to deal with shadow data sets. This utility is used to format the shadow area data sets and the shadow image copy data sets. So we had to introduce two new keywords, active and shadow. Okay, active, this because this utility was used before to format the area data sets, we had to say, but it was the only type of data set it was being formatted, we had to introduce this word active to show that that's what it is doing, and that's the default. The new parameter, the second new parameter is shadow, and so we're using this utility to format the shadow area data set and the shadow image copy data set. So you can format either the active or the shadow area data sets in one execution. All right. If you have DBRC equals yes, then you can format the shadow area and the shadow image copies in one execution. All right. So the definitions are going to come from the new ACB, which is in the staging ACB lab. Okay, so it's in the staging ACB lab waiting to move to the, for, with image happy to move to the real ACB lab. But we need to know what the definitions are for what the data sets are going to look like, the shadow data sets are going to look like. So they use the new ACB member from the staging ACB lab. So once the utility completes, the flags are set in the recon for these shadow area data sets. They're marked as, if it's a shadow data set, then it's marked as shadow avail. And if it's a shadow image copy area data set, then it's marked as shadow image copy avail. Okay. The shadow area data sets must be formatted by this utility before ALTER can run. Okay, page 89. So this is, these are the control statements for the ALTER utility. So the type is ALTER for the utility, and you would say, you would decide whether you're going to use ALTER area or replace RAND. And then there's some information about the data that this utility is going to know, specifically about the kinds of keyed segments. So whether to allow, will it allow unkeyed segments? Will it, you know, then you would use all. If you don't want to allow unkeyed segments, you'd say none. And if you want to use unkeyed segments, but using the insert rule of first or last, then you would say insert FILA, first, last. All right. The other parameters on here are timeout. Okay, so because the DDB ALTER utility is going to quiesce the O1 activity, there could be some kind of activity out there that's not checkpointing correctly. It's not never coming, like a BMP that's not checkpointing for a while, in which case the DL1 ALTER utility would not be able to quiesce the activity. So there's a timeout value in seconds that says, after this number of seconds, it does not appear like you're going to work, so timeout. That's what the timeout value is. And the default is 15 seconds. Page 90. So another key word is retry. So if the question is no, do not try retry this if the timeout value expires, or yes, retry it again. If the timeout value expires, then you know, I want you to try it again. And you can say how many times with the retry value you would like this utility to try again after the timeout occurs. The other thing you can say is retry wait. And what that says is wait for a few seconds. After the timeout expires, wait a few seconds before you retry it. Okay, so you can say retry, you can say retime wait, you can say timeout. A lot of ways of doing this. And they're all because DL1 activity is being quiesced. And it's all about how long it takes to quiesce that activity and then retrying it when the activity has finished. And then the last keyword is goal, which says execute the utility. So page 91. So here's some JCL, what it would look like to run the ALTER utility. And you can see the control statements at the end. Type equals ALTER. This is an ALTER area for this area name. It's how, do you want to retry? No, don't retry it. If it times out after 30 seconds, then don't do any more. Don't go again. So that's what, you know, but you could change retry to yes and put retry wait in there and so on. And then the last statement is goal. So when you would execute this, you would be altering the area DB, the DBD, the area name that's specified there. Okay, so now, page 92, let's talk about the ALTER area function specifics. So I said in the beginning that you can change the UOW, the size, the root, and the randomizer name. Those are the types of changes that you can make using the ALTER utility. ALTER area function. The UOW and the root change the root addressable and independent overflow areas of the DDB, and the size parameter has to do with the CI size. When you change the randomizer name, when we're doing the ALTER, we have to read what's in the active data sets. So that what's in the active data sets, we're going to read using the old randomizer. Okay, so we're going to migrate the active area to the target area then using the new randomizer. So, you know, if your logic is changing, the size of your structure is changing, you might need a new randomizer in order to figure out where everything should go. So after the DDB alter is completed, then FastPath is going to replace the old randomizer using the new randomizer. Okay, so that after that, the new randomizer will be used. Now, couple of restrictions here. The new randomizer must be a two-stage randomizer, not just in definition, but it has to work that way as well. So it has to randomize to the area, that's the first stage, and then it has to randomize within the area, that's the second stage. So it has to be a two-stage randomizer, both in name and in logic. And the other thing is it has to have a new name that is different than the original randomizer name, okay? And for that reason, because you have to change the randomizer name, that is the reason why they came out with the other function called replace randomizer, so you can then immediately go back and say, okay, now I'm going to change the new name back to the original name. All right. So only one active DDB area can change at a time. All right, Joe, you'd have to run this multiple times. Okay, the alter area in this version of IMS does not support DDB databases with SDEPs. Okay, you can replace the randomizer name for DDBs that have SDEPs, you know, using the other function replace randomizer, but alter area does not support DDB databases with SDEPs. All right, let's move to 93. So here are the three parameters that can change: the UOW, the root, and the size. Okay, and this is you can change these things, and I'm just going to tell you what they are. None of this has actually changed at all. It's just that these are the three things that can change. So the UOW is to specify the number of control intervals, total number, and the amount used in the overflow section. So you can change the number, you can change how many are dedicated to the overflow section. The root has to, the UOW is in terms of number of CI, the root is in terms of space. So how much space is allocated to the root addressable part and how much space is allocated to the independent overflow. Okay, so, and then the size the root is space allocated. The number two, which is the root, is the first number, is actually the total amount of space. The second number is the space that's for the independent overflow. All right. The size has to do with CI size, and it's in bytes. So if you want to change the CI size, you would do it with the size parameter. Okay, moving on to page 94. Again, this is sort of review because nothing has changed here, but I'm just showing a picture of what a DDB area looks like. So on the left side, you can see the structure there with the root, dependent, direct dependence, the SDEPs, and then this is what it looks like in VSAM, where you'd start, the head part is the root addressable part, then you'd have the independent overflow part. Then you have this thing called reorganization unit of work, which is actually no longer used, but it's still there. And then at the end, you have all the sequential dependents, the SDEPs. Okay, page 95. And again, this is just exploding in a different way and just showing more detail about how the area is structured. The first CIs are used for control information, CI0, CI1. That's followed by the UOW, the base and the dependents and so on. You get the reorg unit of work, which isn't used, and then you've got the SDEPs at the end. So these last two charts are really review for what the DDB area actually looks like. Okay, page 96. So a couple of examples here. If you wanted to change the DDB area using the same CI size, then maybe you would change the UOW and you would change the root. So you'd change the number of CIs and you change the amount of space where it's allocated. If you wanted to change the DDB area with using a different CI size, then you would change the CI size using size parameter. You change the UOW for the number of CIs and you might change the root where how it's allocated in terms of space. So just examples of what it might look like. Page 97. And pictorially, this is sort of the same kind of thing. We're just looking at, you know, you change your DVD, you say, I want to alter it. Originally, the UOW is 10,2 for the number of CIs, and the space allocation is in the root, and you say, okay, now I want to use the alter area. I'm going to change the DVD and do my DVD gen, do my ACP gen. I want to use the alter area to change it so that now I have a different allocation of how many CIs are UOW and where the space is allocated. So that's what you might be doing with the alter utility. Page 98. Okay, so we're trying to do now. Now let's take a look at how what's actually happening when you issue the DB alter utility. What's happening for execution of an alter area? So the preparation steps were to change the DVD. Okay, you change the UOW, the size, the root, the randomizer name. So you change the DVD, you run the DVD gen, you run the ACB gen. Okay, you allocate your shadow area data sets, you allocate your shadow image copy data sets, you register them with DBRC, you format them with DBF UMIN0. Okay, that's all preparation. Okay, that's all what we talked about already. Now you're ready to execute the DB alter utility, okay, and you're going to use alter area. So you start to run the utility, and the data will be migrated from the active DDB area, okay, to the shadow area data sets. And if you define shadow image copies, you'll be creating these what are really user image copies. It's an image of the data set, okay, at the same time. Okay, so it's going to look at the staging ACB lib in order to figure out what the new size and space allocations are and CI size and so on. That's what it's going to use. It's going to take the data, the definitions from the staging member, the ACB lib member in the staging library. That's what it's going to use in order to format, in order to create the shadow area and shadow image copies. It's going to use the current randomizer, or another way of saying that is the active randomizer, in order to read the active DDB area. Okay, it's going to use if there is a new randomizer, and then you don't have to, but if there is a new randomizer, it's going to use the new randomizer to insert the data into the shadow area data sets. Okay, so this process is going on. It's copying from the active into the shadow. Now, at some point, it's going to near the end of that copy, and it's going to decide it's time to commit that data. And this is all going on. These are the two steps in the alter utility. So it's going to commit that data. It's ready to finish up the processing. So at that point, it's going to quiesce any DO1 activity that's going on against those DDB areas. All right, so it's going to try to quiesce that by quiescing calls when they reach commit points. All right, so when it'll know it, it'll look at everything that's running and say, okay, I'm gonna suspend these calls at these commit points. And at that point, everything will be suspended. So whatever has not been copied over to the shadow area data set is going to be synchronized at that point in time. Whatever remains that wasn't copied already will be copied from the active to the shadow area data set. At that point, there's an ACB live member, all right, that has been sitting in the staging data set. At that point in time, once the activity is quiesced, it will move that member to the active ACB live. That is it. That's what we have always called member online change, and that's what it's driving under the covers is member online change. At that point, the new randomizer replaces the existing randomizer if you defined RM name as one of the things that's changing. So if you're creating a new randomizer, that's during member online change happens, and then you're going to move the randomizer, change the randomizer name as well. Okay. When this process that's been done, online change has been done, the shadow area data set becomes the new DDB area data set. And the original DDB area data sets are then preserved. Okay, they can become the next shadow area data sets. But at this point, they're not used anymore, right? Because shadow area data sets are only used for the DDB alter. They're not used anymore. They're preserved, all right? And the shadow area data sets become the new DDB area data sets. And when that is completed, then FastPath will unquiesce the activity, and any suspended DL1 calls will be resumed. Okay. This is what is happening. It's a two-step process within this DDB Alter utility. Okay, page 99. So if this alter, if all those steps we just talked about are successful, okay, then we would say the DDB alter was successfully run, then the shadow area data set is now promoted to the active area data set, okay? And the old active data set is demoted. Sounds harsh, but it becomes the shadow area data set for the next time you would use the alter utility. All right, the shadow image copy data set is promoted to a user image copy. And a user image copy is a special type of image copy. And it's actually registered in DBRC as a user image copy. It can be, user image copies have some special attributes, but it is still counted in GenMax, which is keeping track of how many image copies should be retained at a given time. But it is not a standard image copy in that it doesn't have all the prefix information on it. So it is instead, it's an image of the active area data set. If you want to use this image copy, you need to notify DBRC to use it, and you would use a command notify.recov with the DBD name, and that would be the DDB, the area name, and the recovery time, which is the timestamp when that shadow image copy was created by the DDB alter utility. All right. Once you've notified DBRC and said this is a user image copy, and you've told them what the time is of it and so on, then if you're using something like genjcl.recov and you don't specify an image copy name and instead you say use area, then it will go in, it'll find that image copy and use it. So it's creating an image copy, but it's a user image copy, so you have to take a couple extra steps to be able to use it. All right, page 100. If the DDB alter is unsuccessful, then the active area datasets remain as the active area datasets, okay, and they're still accessible to IMS. So then it's a question, how far along did we get in this process to determine whether the shadow area data sets are still good? All right. So you have to look in DBRC to see, are the shadow area data sets marked as avail? So if you haven't written anything from the active area data sets to the shadow area data sets, then it really didn't go very far in this alter process. And in that case, the shadow area data sets will still show as avail, and you don't have to recreate them. However, reallocate them and reformat them. However, if they're marked as unavail, which means that some data has already been migrated to them, then the next time you do the alter utility, before doing it, you need to reallocate those shadow area data sets and reformat them with DBF UMIN0. Okay, you don't have to re-register them, you just have to reallocate and reformat. If you change the names of them and so on, you might have to re-register them, but if you don't, then you wouldn't have to do that. Okay, page 101. So this is an example now of what the DDB alter utility looks like, the JCL, for the replace RAND function. And remember, most common use of this is probably going to be after you do the alter area and you change your randomizer name. You might want to change your randomizer name back to the one that it originally was, and then you could use this replace RAND. So the type is alter, replace RAND, retry equals no, timeout equals 30. Very similar, similar parameters to the previous alter area. Page 102, the replace randomizer function, the purpose here is, like I said, you might want to change the name. So the new name, again, has to be a two-stage randomizer, not just in definition, but in logic as well. Okay, it's going to be replacing the existing replacement will be replaced by this new name. Okay. The new name must be different than the original name, just like we had before. And once this alter is done, then the new randomizer will be used for all areas. Okay, and as I said before, replace RAND, it does support DDB databases with or without SDEPs. Okay, page 103. All right, so here's what you have to do in order to the preparation steps for this. You have to assemble and link edit a new randomizer with a different name. Okay, you'd modify your DDB to use the new name. You'd run your DBD gen, run your ACB gen. That'll put the new ACB member into staging ACB Live. And then you execute the alter utility for this replace RAND. What that's going to do is it's going to go look for that new randomizer in the load line, in the step line, IMS library, concatenation. It's going to load the new ACB from the staging ACB Live. Okay, and then that's the first steps, and then the second steps are it needs to commit this change. So it's going to quiesce DL1 activity, just like the alter area did. It's going to go to the staging library and move it to move that ACB member and ACB Live to the active ACB Live, and then it's going to unquiesce and unsuspend any DL1 calls and resume database activity. It's a lot simpler when you're just replacing a randomizer name, replacing a randomizer. It's a lot simpler than the process for changing with the alter area. Okay, page 104. So if the DDB alter is successful in replacing the randomizer name, then the new randomizer replaces the existing randomizer. If it's unsuccessful, then nothing happens. The existing randomizer remains in effect. All right, page 105. So the software prerequisites are all data sharing systems in order to use DDB alter must be at IMS 13. The hardware requirements are the same as IMS 13, and there are no tooling aspects to this change. Page 106. Okay, as I mentioned a couple of times, some other restrictions. The randomizer, you can't just define it as a two-stage randomizer, but it also must have logic that acts like a two-stage randomizer. It has to be able to go to the area and then go within the area. All DDB areas must be registered to DBRC for DDB alter. I talked about the ACB share parameter that says whether the ACB Live is being shared or each IMS system has its own. And the minvers, in order to use DDB alter, the DBRC minvers value must be 13.1. Page 107. So, in summary, the DDB alter allows you to make changes to the DDB specifically for the UOW, the size, the root, and the randomizer name. Without having to take IMS down, you can make these changes. And the way these changes are made are using the DDB alter utility, which under the covers invokes online change, quiesces DL1 activity, makes all these changes. And the benefits of this are it eliminates system downtime when you want to make changes for applications. Okay, that's the end of DDB alter. And I'll just ask, are there any questions at this time?
And that is star one. If you would like to ask a question or make a comment, star one. And it appears there are no questions at this time.
Okay, good. Well, we're going to move on to page 108, the secondary index enhancements. And when we finish with this section, we'll have a break. Okay. Page 109. All right, the FastPass secondary index enhancement. This is what we're talking about now are going to be some PTFs that were added to late in the game to IMS version 12 and then forward fitted, which means that we put them into version 13. So these are both in IMS 12 and in 13, but because they came in late in 12, we thought it was worth talking about now too. So this enhancement, it's not a huge enhancement, but it provides the ability to do some special, add some Boolean operators to SSA or segment search arguments. Specifically, you can do ands and ors, and it supports certain command codes but not others. So it just makes programming opportunities a little bit easier when you're dealing with secondary indexes. The secondary index support went into IMS version 12. Okay, page 110. So these are the APAR numbers on version 12. It's really more interesting from the standpoint of what were the APARs in version 12, because these became part of the IMS version 13, and they're part of the GA version of IMS 13. So page 111. All right, so I'm going to show you some review now of what the secondary index support is that was added to IMS version 12. And then the actual enhancement that we're going to talk about, as you'll see, is very small. This is just a little bit of review. Okay, so there's two types of ways you can have secondary indexes in IMS in FastPath. Okay, so the first way is when the target segment is the same as the source segment. And so you can see, if you look at the definition here for the DVD, you can see that we've introduced, and this was all in version 12, we have the L-child and the XD field values in this in the segment, under the segment. And if you know secondary indexes for full function, you'll recognize that this is done exactly the same for full function and FastPath. So we just introduced this in version 12. So in this case, we say that the secondary index, the source and the target are both in the same segment, and it's the root segment. All right, and then in this case, the search field is going to be HASP address or hospital address, and the name of the segment, name of the index is there as well. All right, page 112. So the physical data structure here is the target is the hospital, and the secondary data structure is the same. The target is hospital and patient is down below. So if we wanted to say, okay, given this structure and we want to use the secondary index, then the key feedback area for patient, all right, which is that segment down at the bottom, I would say, okay, I'm going to use because the target and the source are the same, I'm going to use the secondary index key of hospital, the key of ward, and the key of patient, and that's how I would find the key. That's what the key feedback area for patient would be when the target is the root segment. So page 113, this is all review, so I'm not going to dwell on it. So here's the DVD for the secondary index, where the target root is the same as the source target. You can see we have this the secondary index here. It's pointing to the search field is hospital address, which is part of the hospital segment. Okay, page 114. Now, in this case, this is the second case, and that's where the target and the source segments are not the same. All right, so in this case, the ward segment is where we're defining the secondary index. The secondary index search field is going to be patient ID, and so the source segment is patient. All right, and on the next page, page 115, so this is the structure of this secondary index. In this case, ward is the target. So if we're looking for the key feedback area for hospital, all right, which was in the previous one was the target, the root, then we would say we'd start with the secondary index key, and then we'd take the key of hospital, and that's what would be the key feedback area. And if it was for patient, we'd take the secondary key, index key, plus the key of patient. All right. Page 116. So this is the secondary index definition when the target and the source are not the same. All right, so patient ID is going to be the search argument here. Okay, so that was all review of what went into IMS version 12 in terms of supporting secondary indexes. And the small thing that was added, the next two charts are what was added, And so the first one is the ability to have Boolean support, or ands and ors. An and is represented by an asterisk or an ampersand. An or is represented by a plus sign or a bar, vertical bar. So in this example, the search field was hospital address. So we can say, get it unique for this hospital and use the search field of the secondary index. And then the thing that changed here is a very small change, is right next to Elm Street on the top line there, there's a vertical bar. So that vertical bar is what's come in as part of the support. So we're able to say, use the search argument and using, so say when the get the hospital information, when the search field is Elm Street or the search field is Doe Street. All right. So that vertical bar is what is being, was added, and is in version 13. All right. Page 118. The other thing that was added was the ability to have use multiple search fields or secondary index fields and have multiple SSAs within the same get unique using the search field. That wasn't allowed in the original support, but that has been added to version 12 as a PTF and to version 13. Okay, page 119. So with that multiple SSA and the Boolean support, We support all these command codes that you can put onto the DL1 call. So I'm not going to go through what all these mean, but it's really here for your reference. You can do, these are the ones that actually really make sense to be added. And then on page 120, if you go to page 120, these are the command codes that that are not supported. And if you do use these with that Boolean support with the secondary index support, then the status codes you're going to get are AJ, except for qualified by position, which is AD. Okay, so some command codes are supported and others are not, and these are the lists. So page 121. All right, so in summary, we just talked about the secondary support that was added late to version 12 as PTFs, forward fitted to IMS version 13, and is available within the GA version of IMS 13. So that's the ability to have used ands and ors in segment search arguments when you're using the secondary index search field. And then the ability to use certain command codes, the ones that are supported and the ones that are not supported when you're using the secondary index support. Okay, and then page 122. Okay, and I think this is the point where we'll ask if you have any questions, and then we'll take a break. So are there any questions?
There are no questions at this time. Once again, star 1 to ask a question. There are no questions.
Okay, do you want to take a break?
And you may take your scheduled break. We will resume in 15 minutes. Good day and welcome back to the DBRC Enhancements conference call. Again, today's call is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference back over to Glenn Galler. Please go ahead, sir.
All right, thank you. So we are now on page 122. And this is the DBRC migration and coexistence section. So if you turn to page 123, we'll start. So the supported migrations for IMS version 13, you can move from IMS version 11 to 13, or you can move from IMS version 12 to 13. So what that means is you need to apply some coexistence code to IMS version 11 or version 12, depending on the version you have. And these are the APAR numbers that are listed. This coexistence code will allow IMS 11 to understand IMS 13 recon records, and the same for version 12. So that's the first thing, coexistence. All right, page 124. Once you've applied a coexistence code, then you can do a display, you can do a command that's, you know, display the subsystem record. And when you do that, since IMS version 10, it will show you the coexistence level. So once you've applied the 13 code, if you look at the version, the subsystem record for in the recon, it'll show you the coexistence level is 13.1. But it'll also show you that you're currently running on an IMS 11 recon. So the current version that you're running is IMS 11. The coexistence level is 13.1. Okay, page 125. All right. So let's talk about doing the upgrade from version 11 to version 13. One of the things that was introduced in IMS version 12 was that IMS DBRC wants to create what's called the DMB table, all right, which is a table of all the databases that are registered in DBRC. They created that in version 12, and we have that in version 13. And when you move from version 11 to version 13, they're going to try to create that table. And so it turns out that at some point in time in the history of DBRC, something happened to that table such that for DMBs, all DMBs that are registered, all databases that are registered, there's a high order bit that should be turned on. And at some point in the history of IMS, in some cases, and they don't know exactly where, whether it was IBM or a vendor tool or user code, but there are certain situations where that high order bit was not turned on. And they noticed this in IMS version 12 and IMS 13 when they're creating that database table. So DBRC tries to turn that bit on during the migration, during the upgrade. And so it can turn it on if the database is not authorized. It'll just turn it on. But if the database is authorized, and the reason it might be authorized is because you're upgrading the recon with IMS is still up and running and the database is authorized, then, or started, then that, if the database is authorized at that point in time, then IMS cannot turn that database, that high order bit, on, in which case it'll put out an error message during the upgrade. So if it's not, the database is not authorized, IMS, DBRC can turn that bit on, then it'll put out a warning message that says there was something wrong with this database, this DMB number, because the high order bit was not on, but it was corrected. Okay, but it'll actually fail the upgrade if the database is authorized and it can't turn on that bit. So it's a odd situation that this bit is not on, and the truth is IMS development can't figure out where or who or how this situation has happened, but it's trying to correct it at this point in time. Okay, page 126. In IMS version 12, they introduced a new keyword called checkup. So you do a change.recon upgrade checkup. And what happens is DBRC, and this came out in 12, and it's also available in 13, and from now on it'll be available. This DBRC command will check whether the upgrade is going to be successful. So it's going to check almost everything that could possibly fail. It reads all the records, and it doesn't do the upgrade, but it checks what would happen if it did the upgrade. So, for example, if this DMB number, high order bit in the DMB number was not turned on and the database was authorized and it couldn't turn it on, then the recon upgrade checkup would give a return code of 12 saying, this upgrade is going to fail because I can't turn that bit on. So the upgrade checkup command is useful to check for common things that might be going wrong in the recon prior to actually doing the upgrade. Okay, page 127. Okay, so the recons are upgraded. First you install IMS 13, then you do your coexistence code, you upgrade using the DBRC utility, you do the upgrade. The rules are that if IMS is going to be up and running while you're doing the upgrade, then you need two recons and a spare. If IMS is not going to be up and running, which means there's no subsystem records, then only two recons are required. Okay. Now, this is just a test environment, then one recon is okay. Now, when I've talked to many customers, most customers say that they don't actually upgrade the recon when IMS is up and running. But it is possible, and if you're going to do it when IMS is up and running, then 2 weekends and a spare are required. So it's important to have already applied the DBRC coexistence SPE before you do the upgrade. And if you're doing your upgrade and IMS is up and running and the subsystem, you know, you do it, your subsystem record for 11 or 12 indicates that that you have not applied the coexistence SPE, then it's going to fail the upgrade. Now, there are some utilities that don't actually check to see whether the coexistence SPE has been applied, like change accume or log archive or the partition definition utility. These don't check this subsystem record, so they're not going to know whether the coexistence is applied. So long and short, apply the coexistence SPE before you do your upgrade. Okay, page 128. Okay, so the DMB table that I talked about that needs the higher to bid on, that's created when you move from 11 to 13. It was introduced in 12, so if you're already on 12, that table would already exist. Okay, so we say that some recon records in version 13 are going to be bigger than 11 or 12, so you want to ensure that your recon is going to be large enough to be able to handle this upgrade. Especially if you're coming from 11 to 13 because of that DMB table, you want to make sure that your recon that you're upgrading has enough secondary extents so that it can handle a larger size. All right, page 129. So when you're going from version 11 to 13 reads the assist subsystem records to check if the coexistence SPE is there. That coexistence level is correct. You applied it. It's going to create the DMB table by reading all the database records, checking the high order bit, trying to turn it on, failing if it can't turn it on. That's the next thing that happens, going 11, 13. It's going to build that DMB table once all these DMB numbers are corrected. Okay. At that point, it's going to update the recon header, and it's going to set the version indicator that we looked at earlier, and it's going to set the minvers value, and we'll discuss that in a minute. It's going to update the recon header extension record with the version indicator. And then once all of these previous steps are completed, after copy one is upgraded, it will copy from copy one to copy two. Okay, that's the process for 11 to 13. Okay, page 130. It's a little simpler from version 12 to version 13 because the DMB table has already been corrected and created. So it's going to read the subsystem record to check for the SPE coexistence APAR level. It's going to update the recon header to set the version indicator and the minvers value. It's going to update the version indicator and the header extension record. And then once that's done, it'll copy one is going to be upgraded and copy two will be copied over to copy two. Copy one will copy to copy two. All right, simpler version 12 because all that mess with the DMB table will have already been taken care of. Okay, page 131. So if anyone has parallel recon access, then what's going to happen? The upgrade's a little basically the same. Well, the only thing is that any recon activity is going to be quiesced. The recon is going to be closed and reopened in local shared resource mode. Once that's done, then the same process can continue to upgrade the recon. The copy one is copy to copy two. Recons are then reopened in parallel mode. And the quiesce is ended. So it's basically the same thing, only we have to copy the close and reopen the recon in local shared resource mode. All right, page 132. All right, so minvers, the minvers valid values, all right, are 11.1, 12.1, and 13.1. Okay, those are the valid values for minvers. And minvers is used because certain line items that come in require, you know, something to be at the 12 level or the 13 level. So we use minvers and DBRC to ensure that the IMS systems are at the right level. So when we're upgrading the recons, if the minvers were 10.1, okay, which was valid, you know, for version 12, then it's going to be automatically changed to 11.1. So if the min versus is 11.1 during the upgrade, it'll remain at 11.1, which is a valid value. If it's 12.1, it'll remain at 12.1. So min vers 12.1 was required for some function that went into version 12, which was the use of APPC synchronous conversations and OTMA CM1 commit, you know, send a message and then commit. So send the output message and then commit. So certain functions that went into 12.1 required min vers 12.1. For 13.1, if you're doing synchronous program-to-program switch and shared in a shared queues environment, which Susie and Ken talked about a couple of days ago, or if you're doing HelDB alter, which Nancy talked about this morning, or you're doing DDB alter, which I just talked about an hour ago, those require min vers of 13.1. Okay. Page 133. Now there's a special situation for min vers in that if you're on version 11, a valid min vers value would be 9.1. Okay, that's an unsupported version right now, but that, and if you're on version 11, you could still have min vers of 9.1. And the reason this is a little special is because in version 10, we introduced a line item called DBRC Precision Timestamp, where all the timestamps in DBRC, image copies, change of cumes, and so on, could now have a 6 degrees, you know, right of the decimal point. In other words, you know, not instead of having 1/10 of a second precision, it goes up to six different, you know, numbers. I don't know what that number is, but one, you know, millionth or beyond, actually quite beyond that. A much more refined timestamp went in DBRC precision timestamp because the processors were getting very fast at that time, as they are now, and the chance of having two timestamps to the 10th of a second, we could end up with the same timestamp for two different change of cues or image copies. So in version 10, we came out with a line item DBRC precision timestamp, and we said, in order to use this, you need min vers equals 10.1. So it's possible that if you're on 11, it's possible you might have 9.1 as your min vers, in which case you wouldn't be using when you're creating image copies, you wouldn't be getting these timestamps for your image copies that are very precise. So and when you're going from 11 to 13, we're going to change the min vers to 11.1. So you're all of a sudden you're going to be getting these timestamps that are of a more, you know, more precise timestamps. So there's two things that could occur. If you do a change acume, you might have image copies that have one, you know, 10th of a second precision that you're using, and that's not a good thing. So what we want, you know, once you get to version 13. So what we recommend is after you upgrade your recon to, you upgrade a recon and the min vers gets set to 11.1, that before you run any change of cume jobs, you rerun all your image copy jobs so that you get the higher precision. That'll give you the higher precision, and then when you do your change of cume, you'll be ensured of getting the right image copies in the right order. All right, so this problem that I'm talking about only applies if you're on 11.1 and you have min vers equals 9.1 today. Okay. So if you, the other thing that could happen is if you have any jobs that reference the recon, you have to ensure now that they can handle a more increase in precision in the DBRC timestamp. Again, this function came out back in 10.1, and the only reason I'm mentioning it now is because it's possible you would still have your min vers value set at 9.1, which is prior to the 10.1 when precision timestamp came in. Okay. So long explanation for something that's probably very rarely going to occur, but something to think about if you have min vers equals 9.1. All right, page 134. Here's another situation that it's recommended that if you're running log archive jobs on 11 and 12 and you've already upgraded your recons to version 13, then the version 13 records, these are DBRC records, are going to be converted into 12 and 11 when you run a 12 or 11 log archive job. And so you're going to have both 11 or 12 DBRC records in memory. At the same time, you're going to have the version 13 records in memory. So you're going to need more memory, okay, if you're in this situation. You've upgraded the recon, you're running an 11 or 12 log archive job, you're going to end up with twice the amount of records in memory. So the recommendation is use region equals 0M so you can deal with in the increase in memory demands, okay, until you get up to version 13. Okay, so these are specialized situations. All right, so page 135. So the migration steps are you apply 11 or 12. My version 13 migration coexistence SPE is to 11 or 12. You install the version 13 DBRC Type 4 SVC, okay? You upgrade the recons using the code in IMS version 13, and then you start using IMS version 13, and you discontinue use of 11 and 12. That's the standard process. And then you can change that recon, the min version 11, to version to 13.1. Okay. All right, so that's the end of the what's required for DBRC migration and coexistence. Are there any questions about that before I tell you about a small line item that went into DBRC?
Thank you. Once again, star one at this time for any questions. And we do have a question, and that will come from Susana Fernandez.
Hello. No, just a comment regarding the MinVerse 9.1. That's not a weird situation. I have it now, and I'm upgrading to my to MS version 13. That was all.
Okay. So keep that right. I shouldn't say it's uncommon because it certainly can occur. And the thing to think about, which you may not have considered, is that when you're by going now, are you going from 11?
Yes.
So by going to from 11, at this point you probably don't have those precision timestamps because you have 9.1. So you're going to see a difference in these timestamps when you're looking at image copies. So it would be a good idea to rerun your image copies so that you can create those better timestamps so that change accumulation will not be. It probably won't be confused, but it could get the image copies out of order.
Yes. Okay. Yeah.
So thanks for making that comment.
And once again, star one at this time for any questions. And it appears there are no further questions at this time.
Okay. So let's move on to page 136. This is a very small enhancement. You can argue whether it's an enhancement or a fix, but we're going to tell you about it anyways. It's called the delete log inactive and two-time commands. So move on to page 137. So there's a command in DBRC called delete.log, which allows you to delete DBRC prilog and setlog records. That's not to be confused with log, INS log records. These are DBRC prilog and setlog records. And for up to version 13, IMS determined if it could delete those records using the start time of those log records. And that was a problem because that start time might be when the stop time for those log records was created, it may be a very long time later. So what happened is that for the log retained setting, which determines when to delete those log records, if the start time was being used, it could be that the stop time was still within that log retained value, in which case it really shouldn't delete those log records. So IMS changed this in version 13 to say instead of looking at the start time, they'll look at the stop time, and if the stop time is before the log retained time, then they'll allow those records to be deleted. So that's the change that was made. It's a very small change, but it came into version 13 of DBRC, and we thought we'd tell you about it. or are there any questions about that?
And once again, that is star one to ask a question. And we'll hear from Dale Backhues of CSC.
Yes, I have a question for you. Would this improve? We have this one thing where we do that delete log during when it happens over the time change, and we have an issue where if it's not done at a certain time, it has a problem with the timestamp. Would this change help on that situation?
You mean because of the because over the time change the it's a well.
That's always been kind of a pain. You always want to make it go before the time change because it's really a hassle if it doesn't happen then.
Right.
Or do you have a better way for that?
Yeah.
It like tries to delete back certain records that's back so many years and it can't seem to handle the time change.
Right. I doubt if this is going to be impacted by that. I mean, my guess is that it's not going to be impacted by that.
It's probably not going to be improved by that.
That's what I really tried to say. It's not going to be improved by that.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, thank you.
Yeah, that was a good question.
And there are no further questions at this time.
So at this point, I'm going to turn it over to my colleague, Dennis Eichelberger, who's going to talk about migration and installation.
Thank you, Glenn. We've got a new file coming up. IMS 13 installation and migration should be the title of the file. So if everyone has moved over to that, I'll move on slide two. Basically, we're going to just talk about some installation and migration considerations. We've got packaging, prerequisites, coexistence, IMS library updates, some of the installation and migration tasks. We've listed as many as we can, and we know everyone is unique. So if there's questions on that, please feel free at the end of the session to bring those up. Some review of the migration considerations. And then as an appendix, we have IMS tool support. There's a list of PTFs required, needed, suggested for IMS tools from IBM. This is mostly an appendix information, so it's in the file. If there's questions on that, we can handle that individually, because not everyone has that set of tools. Okay, page three and on to four, packaging. Here we're showing our FMIDs and our program number. IMS 13 program number is 5635-A04. Note you have an IMS component ID for retain, which is basically the same number without the dash, 5635A0400. And then our features descriptions with the FMIDs that the SMP folks installing it would need to be aware of. They're all similar to version 12, but there's a list of them right here. Note that at the bottom, and we've talked about this before, when you request IMS 13 via SHOPC or PDO, you are going to get IRLM 2.3. So be aware of that. Software prerequisites otherwise on page 5. Minimum software prerequisites. ZOS version 1, R13. You're going to need RACF or an equivalent, ACF or Top Secret. High-level assembler toolkit release 5, and there's the code for that. That's for the sysgens. Going to need APARs onto your ZOS system of OA39392 and OA36172 with their PTFs. If you're planning on using the ZIP offload, which we talked about on Tuesday, you're going to need OA39392 also. And IRLM 2.3 for IMS 13 is going to be your IRLM that's used there. Optional functions for Java-dependent regions. I'm on slide 6. For JDK 601, ISC TCP IP is going to require CICS 5.1 if you're planning on implementing ISC over TCP IP connection. Talked about native SQL for COBOL. This is going to require COBOL 5.1 plus PM92523, and that adds the IMS coprocessor function. So if you're also going to go there, IMS 13 is going to require the two PTS listed, UK98028 and 98418, be applied to your IMS. Depending on what particular environment for IMS universal drivers, you're going to require the IBM JDK 6.0.1 or later, DB2 version 9.1 or later, WAS version 7 or later, CICS version 4.1 or later. Recall that's going to be if you're not using TCP IP for ISC. The .NET provider for IMS Enterprise Suite 3.1 is going to require DRDA support for native SQL flows in IMS 13. It's also going to require implementation of the Common Service Layer, CSL, IMS Connect, ODBM, and the catalog. There are requirements for the catalog. I'll get to those in a couple of slides, I believe. If you're going to think about using DB versioning, which was talked about previously today, that the requirement for that is to use the IMS catalog. Slide 7, other optional functions. Minimum levels for some of these. IMS 13 is going to support DB2 version 9, 10, and 11. We note here that the DB2 11 QPP started at the same time as the IMS 13 QPP. So those are going hand in hand. CICS is supported for versions 3.2, 4.1, 4.2, and 5.1. Note here, again, CICS 5.1 is required for the ISC using TCP IP. And that also requires ZOS 1.13. MQ for ZOS, supported under version 7.0.1 and 7.1. 7.01 introduced message expiry, interfacing with IMS transaction expiration. And 7.1 enhanced the support and support for OTMA resource monitoring. Slide 6, hardware prerequisites for IMS 13. IMS 13 runs only on 64-bit processors running Z architecture mode. These processors also must support long displacement facility of the Z architecture. ESA mode is not supported. There's a note here with the URL for the Z-Series machines that you could look up if you need to. If you're still on using Z900 machine levels, they must be at a GA2 level, which is microcode level 3G or later. So if that's a concern, please check with your hardware folks and make sure that that is available. Sysflex data sharing for those of you that are data sharing, including data caching and VSO data sharing. Custom facility at a level 9 or later. On to 9. Shared queues and shared EMH support. EMH is expedited message handler for FastPath. It's going to require a coupling facility level of 9 or later. If you are using or thinking of using system-managed coupling facility duplexing, the coupling facility level needs to be at 12 or later with bidirectional CF-to-CF links. We talked about this earlier. EAV support for non-VSAN data sets. They're supported on the DASI DS8000 at a microcode level of release 4.0. That's from September 2008. Just as an awareness, in case you're wondering how current that is and you need to look it up, it's been around a little while. Again, if you need that, make sure that you're check with your hardware folks and make sure that it is available. Prerequisite maintenance. How to get that? Run an SMPE report missing fix cat. And we've got the a list here of the categories that we have defined for IMS. The red ones are for tools. The black ones are for IMS. The keywords are based here upon which IMS you're looking for. So for version 13, which would be the third category down, our keywords are IMS V13 coax /K. And the description of that is the fixes that allow both IMS version 11 and version 12 to coexist with and fall back to or from IMS 13. At the bottom of this page, we've got a little highlighted. This is our URL for the fix categories. slide 11, a little bit of history, recent history. IMS 10 GA, October 26, 2007. Its end of marketing was September 12, 2011, and end of support a year later, November 12, 2012. So this is out of support. IMS 11 GA, October 30, 2009. End of marketing is September 9, 2013. Its end of support is announced to be this year, October 30, 2014. For IMS 12, GA'd on October 28, 2011, no end of marketing and no end of support has been announced for IMS 12. IMS 13, GA'd October 25, 2013, currently available. This is what we're talking about migrating to now. Withdrawn support along various levels. IMS 11 is the last release to support smoother RACF utilities. You know, subnote under there, IMS was the 9 was the last version to support SMU, the security maintenance utility. So migration from SMU to RACF or equivalent should have been done on IMS 9 or earlier. We talked about this earlier too. IMS 12 is the last release to support the security macro in the system definition. Your sysgen will no longer be required to have the security macro. The parameters have been moved to initialization proc members. If you want to prepare yourself for this and you're on version 12 or version 11, we have SPEs that will retrofit this function to both version 12 and version 11, allowing you to remove the security macro from your sysgen and be prepared for IMS 13. Also under that, there are three security exits that are no longer in the IMS 13 nucleus. They are now standalone in 31-bit private, releasing a little bit of 24-bit space. These are the sign-on exit, DFS-CSGN0, the transaction exit, DFS-CTRN0, and the transaction refresh exit, DFS-CTSE0. The sign-on exit is now called at IMS initialization. So if you have those exits involved and they're still in the nucleus, there will be changes made, and you need to be aware of some of the functions that we talked about that are changing along with those exits. Passing addresses back and forth, being able to address each of the other routines. So if you have these exits, another point to be aware of. Slide 12. Withdrawn support. The IMS Enterprise Suite version 2.1. This is the last release to include DLI model utility plugin. So if you require two functions below, XML DB not being supported, and certain IMS database web services, you may continue to use this version. Otherwise, it's recommended that you migrate to the IMS Enterprise Suite Explorer for development. JCA resource adapter is no longer going to be enhanced. Recommendation here is use the IMS Universal DB resource adapter instead. IMS 13 is going to be the last release to support IMS Connect SSL functions. So instead of that, and in preparation for SSL functions being no longer supported, recommend moving to the IBM ZOS Communication Server Application Transparent Transport Layer Security, and that's a mouthful. So we have an acronym for it, ATLAS. IMS 13 is also going to be the last release to support the IMS MFS web enablement. If you're using this function, recommending that you migrate to IBM Rational Host Access Transformation Services. That's HAS. IMS 13 is also the last release to support classic Java APIs. If you're using a classic Java API, you should migrate to the IMS Universal JDBC driver. Withdrawn support for Enterprise Workload Manager. There is transition assistance for EWM customers available. The Tivoli tools offer a workload automation and monitor solutions. Next slide, 15. Other withdrawn support. IMS 11 is the last release supporting knowledge-based log analysis facility, the KBLA. If you're using this function, there are other IMS-provided analysis utilities and reports, and there's a list of them here. We have FastPath log analysis utility, our file select and formatting print utility, IMS monitor report, log transaction analysis utility, offline dump formatter, statistical analysis utility. We also have available other complementary products such as the IMS Problem Investigator, the Performance Analyzer, which are log analysis utilities, and similar products. Next slide is 16. Supported connections. IMS 13 for ISC, IMS 13, IMS 12, and IMS 11 are supported. ISC is also supported CICS transaction server at version 4.2, 4.1, 3.2, and 3.1. And we support the transaction server for CICS version 5.1 for the TCP IP connectivity over ISC. User written software also. MSC is supported for IMS 13, 12, and 11. Shared queue support is supported across IMS 13, 12, and 11. Slide 17. Glenn just talked about some of this. Migration and coexistence from previous releases. For DBRC, IMS 11 coexistence APAR is PM53134, and the 12 coexistence APAR is 53139. Migration for the security and coexistence SDEs here, eliminating R class and set count out of the security macro, add support into execution parameters. So again, we have PM48203 for IMS 11. If you wanted to prepare yourself for the security macro going away. IMS 12, the APAR is 48204 and 73558. IMS 13 does support RSR migration and coexistence from and with IMS 11 and IMS 12. Next slide. DRA interface modules must be at the same version as IMS. So copy DFS PRRC0 and DFS PSP load modules into the address spaces which are communicating with IMS. Include these modules from IMS in the CICS, ODBM, ODBA, DB2 stores, procedures, WebSphere, etc. address spaces. And this will allow them to interface correctly. The conversion of OTMA and IMS Connect storage pools to cPool in its XRCF SRB exits. This improves performance. We talked about this earlier as to why. Less CPU intensive and faster memory acquisition. However, be aware that in doing so, we're adding 167 megabytes of virtual storage to extended virtual private for IMS Connect. There's also a small addition in the control region of 256K. So be aware of that as you move forward, checking the region sizes on these tasks. Migration with DRD, dynamic resource definition. IMS 13 system may be cold started with RDDS from IMS 12 or IMS 13 as long as the IMS ID remains the same. That's a mandatory requirement. On a fallback, IMS 12 or IMS 11, that system may be cold started with RDDDS from IMS 13. Again, if the IMS ID remains the same. Using the IMS repository requires a minimum level of IMS 12 resource manager. Big note. Ensure that all RMs are at the IMS 12 or IMS 13 level if you're using the DRD repository. Coexistence maintenance required for mixed release DRD environments. IMS 12 and 13 that use the repository, and either IMS 10 or IMS 11 that use RDDS. Here's the APARs for that. IMS 10 APAR is PM19025, and the IMS 11 APAR is PM19026. The slide 22. There's a APAR PM77568 repository change list enhancement. This requires a version 12 coexistence PMR of 80588. That APAR is coexistence APAR for IMS version 12 with IMS 13 and required by all 12 users in the IMS RFC repository in a mixed environment of IMS 12 and 13. It has to be applied before IMS version 13 APAR 77568 is applied. Okay, if you're version 12, if you have no SCI, RM, OM in your IMS Plex, then the APAR 80588 is not a requirement. Okay, the description of that, if you want to look it up, when query, update, and delete of a change list is being processed by a version 12 resource manager address space, this APAR adds logic to disable the supported the unsupported functions from IMS version 12. CSL coexistence, common service layer. The CSL address spaces may be at mixed levels based upon your environments. The SCI, OM, RM, ODBM, and IMS subsystems may be at any of IMS 13, 12, or 11 levels. It is recommended, however, that you go to the highest level of the CSL. So the IMS 13 level of the CSL is recommended even for mixed level sharing. Coexistence maintenance required for the mixed release CSL environments. IMS 12 to 13 with RM and IMS 10, 11 with RM. Our PTFs here for IMS 10, 32951, and IMS 11, 32766. So in order to do this, you are going to have check maintenance for these two. Slide 24. In a shared queues environment with mixed release IMS systems, the PTF 757 addresses some downward compatibility issues, along with correcting an OC4. DVRC minimum of a 12.1 or greater applies to environments where XCF is set to something other than N. A note here, see Chapter 4 of the Release Planning Guide for Coexistence Maintenance Requirements. We've got two URLs here. The first one is for the Information Center, and the second one is for the more current and moving to Knowledge Center. Some additional maintenance. There is a new log record type, 2931. It's written before HALDB online reorganization start time so the products performing a point-in-time recovery can build the output target data sets when a point-in-time recovery is done. This record is mostly a copy of the 2930 log record. It has some information excluded from it, the USID and USN. They will not be in the 2931. The impact here to any modifications or user programs that you have that read these records, have to be aware that there is a new record that might be affected, the 2931. some additional maintenance. We have a Type 47 log record restructure. What we're doing here, this is addressing some potential add-ins and storage overlays that occur when the Type 47 record overlay storage on the end of the log work area. And what happened in previous versions is when a BMP does not take a checkpoint before updating, and I'm sure that there's no one out there who has never experienced this. If more than 300 database data sets were opened in IMS 12 or 242 in IMS 11. So we had some PTFs for IMS 12 and IMS 11 that were added and provided a stopgap solution, increasing the maximum in IMS 11 and 12. We have here a description based on the log record allocation size, if n equals the decimal number, et cetera, of the log, IMS log data set. Then we changed the limit, basically 64N of the minus 15 for 12 and 64N minus 10 for IMS 11. So on to the next slide, 27, which is really where we are for IMS 13, and this is what we're trying to put out here now in this presentation, is there are no limitations. The Type 47 log record is now spanned, and that will handle as many databases and as many database updates as necessary. So there are effectively no limitations. So this means that the BMP not taking checkpoints can go ahead and not take checkpoints and not affect the log record. Might affect its recovery over time, but this is a BMP issue that's always been there. So this is brought up because if you are have a user exit or a utility that reads these log records, 47 log records, you have to be aware that this log record is now spanned and restructured and will be different in version 13. Slide 28, some coexistence for utilities. Batch backout, log archive, and log recovery. Recommend use the utility from the IMS release that created the log. So if version 11 created your log archive, use that utility from that version. IMS 13 database recovery utility is going to accept image copies produced by IMS 13, 12, and 11. It's also going to accept high SAM unloads produced by IMS 13, 12, and 11. The same with change accumulation data sets. It will also accept as input logs produced by 13, 12, and 11 of IMS. The IMS 13 change accumulation utility will accept logs from all three versions and also change accumulation data sets produced by those three versions. Slide 29. Remote site recovery. IMS 13 RSR tracking can process logs created by IMS 13, 12, or 11. The IMS RSR isolated log sender can send logs created by 13, 12, or 11. Logs created by IMS 13 cannot be processed by IMS 12 or 11 tracking system or the isolated log sender. So while you can send them, the IMS 13 needs to be used to process those on your tracking or log sender. The migration steps to do this. Upgrade the RSR tracking system reconst to 13. Migrate your RSR tracking system to IMS 13. Upgrade your active system reconst to 13. And migrate your active system transport subsystem, the TMS, running the isolated log sender to 13. And then migrate active IMS to IMS 13, be it from 11 or 12. Slide 30, in general, some of the log records I just spoke about, the 2931 and the 47 records, are changed. There are some new records added. So all of your DSECs, if you have a program that requires looking at these records, all of these DSECs are found by assembling the iLogRec macro with a rec ID equals all. And that will create all of the DSECs that are published. If you have one of these utilities or programs of your own that reads block records, it's likely that you're familiar with this. Just be aware that if you have one of these programs, you do have to make some changes based upon log records that you're looking at. Okay, IMS library updates on slide 31, on the slide 32. Our information center at IMS 13 is being phased out. We're moving this to the knowledge center, which is the next bullet down. Here's the URL to get there. And a quick picture of what the first stage of that screen will look like when you bring it up. And on the next page, 23, there's a screenshot of the Knowledge Center. There's a Getting Started, a Knowledge Center, and Resources Available. It's similar to the Information Center with some really good search arguments, and it will be our current repository for all of our manuals. The great thing about the manuals from version 12 to version 13 is the titles remain the same. There's no switching back and forth trying to figure out which manual that you're in. I always consider that to be a good thing. Okay, installation and migration tasks on 34 and on to 35. Starting with, review the release planning guide. Check your PSD bucket. For any new fixes, your PSD upgrade name is IMS 1300. Review your program directory through the Knowledge Center. Review the installation information in Chapter 1 on the installation publication. Make sure you get all of your prerequisite and coexistent software and maintenance available. And please note, while we talked about IMS Engine here, if you have IMS tools or related products, please check the maintenance for that, either with the IBM tools folks or with that particular vendor that you're using. Next, apply coexistence maintenance to other IMS systems. And 36, update any IMS exit routines that you may need to rework. We talked about the three security exits. Those will have a new parameter containing storage addresses to be backed up for us. If you're using a recon IO exit, DSPCE XT0, be aware that you may have to allow for some new records and extended records that are held in DBRC. Install the IMS 13 using our standard SMP installation process, that would be CBPDO or server pack. Perform your system definition. On slide 37, install your Type 2 and Type 4 SVCs. They are compatible downward to the two supported releases, 12 and 11. Upgrade your recons. Perform your ACB gen. And run the installation verification program. Now, a lot of people just go a certain way into the IVPs or just do various checks on that. And we always recommend that you go through the IVP for all of the facilities and features that you're using just to make sure they work, and it gives you a familiarity with any changes that may have come up from one release to the next. We always recommend running the IVP highly. 38, and on to 39, reviewing some migration considerations. OTMA Global Flood Control. There are enhancements to two messages, DFS 4388 and DFS 0793. So if you have automation programs that look at those messages, you may have to check those programs to see if they need to be changed or modified. There are two new messages, the 3428 and 3429 messages. Again, they may have to be applied to your automation systems. Changes in default values. The OTMA global flood limit is moved from 8,000 to 10,000. The release value is decreased from 6,400 to 5,000. Our start team member all input is changed. Previously, in previous releases, it only resulted in a warning message. It's now going to turn on global control and reject new input. So you have to be aware of this impact. slide showing that pre-IMS 13, the command did not trigger a flood status, just a warning message. IMS 13, it now immediately takes effect. There are more messages waiting to be processed. They will be rejected. New input's not going to come on until those messages go below the flood control limit. Slide 41, maximum XML converters that can be loaded. This is increased to 2,000 from 100. A couple of WTOR displays and a Type 2 display to show how to see that. Maximum converter is shown in red in the first display. And in the Type 2 command, also in red, with a slightly different format. Slide 42, IMS Connect recorder traces have been expanded. They're going to capture entire messages sent and received using all TCP/IP communications, including DRD sockets and ISC. MSCI, the OM-ODBM, MSC, and ISC communications. So be aware, turning on the trace in IMS 13, same method to turn it on as in IMS 12, with level high, but it can produce significant trace records. So ensure that in order to trap all these trace records that your BPE has external tracing enabled. Some information for Enterprise Suite 3.1. We have some program numbers, program directories, and components supplied in the CBPDO. Slide 43, Enterprise Suite 3.1.net requirements. Some software requirements there. IMS Connect, CSL, DBM. A catalog is required. Some fixes for IMS. IMS Enterprise Suite 3.1.net provider, Visual Studio, and XP and at Service Pack 3 or later versions of Windows. Here's a URL for the distribution site for Enterprise Suite 3.1.net, data provider. It's got some information regarding installation. IBM Installation Manager is a product you download to your laptop or desktop in order to track installations being done on your PC and upgrades and maintenance as required. The Enterprise 3.1 Connect API for Java. Here's some information regarding the software required, ZOS and IMS. Some functions are unavailable at the lower level, version 11. And Java runtime and development kit versions and Microsoft Windows 7. The Connect API for C, so lists similar following our software requirements here. Slide 48, SOAP Gateway. We've got IMS, SOAP Gateway is requiring ZOS version 1.13 or later, IMS versions 13, 12, and 11 with some additional APARs. Java Technology Edition, version 7, Rational Developer for System Z, version 9 or later. Some requirements for business events, for WebSphere events. Version, I'm going on the slide 49. Migration information from migrating services and properties from version 2.1 or 2.2 of SOAP Gateway. We changed the correlator schema. Some information on migrating that. Enhanced migration support of server properties listed on there. All of these are things based upon Enterprise Suite. Okay, versioning migration considerations on slide 50. Enable the catalog. This is a requirement for versioning. Populate the catalog with your DVD versions definitions. Before versioning is enabled for a database, IMS is going to only recognize the current active database definition. So some recommendations we have here for versioning. Specify a new DVD and PSB statement version attributes. Use DVD level equals current setting if you want all applications to access the latest and greatest versions of your databases. Use the PCB DB version parameter if an application needs to continue using an old version of a database. Opposite that, if you want all applications to, as a default, look at the database that is the oldest or the base one that you started out versioning with, use DB level equals base. If you are in an IMS Plex and want to do versioning, all IMSs in that Plex must be at IMS version 13. Okay, and then enable database versioning DB in your DFS DF member. LDB alter migration considerations. Enable your common service layer, the CSL. This is needed because you need OM and the SCI because you're using type 2 commands in order to initiate the alters. Without this, there are no type 2 commands, so LDB alter is not going to work. In DBRC, you have to have a minimum version in the recon of 13.1 in order to support LDB alter. So there's new several DBRC list commands producing output fields. Be aware of that if you're using an API or query output to take a look at all of this. The content of some of the records have changed. So again, if you're using the DSP CEXT0 exit or an API, be aware of those changes. A recommendation, if you want to use alter and alter the segments within a database, and it's needed, but you don't have HALDB, the recommendation is convert them to HALDB. There's no reason why a HALDB has to be multiple partitions. If it's a small database and it's in a single partition, it can still be a HALDB. That gives you the capability of using alter against it. And also, again, if you're in an IMS Plex, they all must be IMS 13 for alter. Slide 52 is for IMS tools. The rest of the information in this handout is specific to our IMS tools. Then there, I'm going to treat it as an appendix. However, if there are questions regarding that, I'll be glad to take them either now or you can send it into the email site, and we'll address them then. That's all I have. So let's open it up for questions now. Anything on the migration considerations to IMS 13?
And once again, that is star 1 to ask a question or make a comment. Once again, star 1 to ask a question or make a comment. We'll pause for a moment. And it appears there are no questions at this time. Now we would like to ask you to participate in a brief electronic survey. Your feedback is important to us, and we do appreciate the time you take to answer these questions. To participate, simply press the star key followed by the number that best corresponds to your choice. Please listen to all options before making your selection. And for question one, please evaluate your level of satisfaction with today's teleconference. If it was high, press star 1. If it was medium, press star 2. And if it was low, press star 3. We'll pause for a brief moment. Question 2 was the level of technical information presented in this teleconference. If it was at the right level, press star 1. If it was not technical enough, press star 2. If it was more technical than I needed to hear, press star 3. And for our third question, what version of IMS do you currently have in production? If IMS 10, press star 1. If IMS 11, press star 2. If IMS 12, press star 3. And for our fourth question, when do you plan to migrate to IMS 13? If you have already migrated to IMS 13, press star 1. If in the next 6 months, press star 2. If 12 or more months away, press star 3. For our fifth question, would you like more information about IBM service offerings for migrating to IMS 13? If yes, press star 1. If no, press star 2. If not sure or need more information, press star 3. And for our final question, we hope you have enjoyed this teleconference today. Please let us know if you are interested in receiving information on this solution. If yes, press star 1. If no info is desired at this time, press star 2. And that concludes our survey. Thank you all for your participation. At this time, I would like to turn the conference back over to our presenters for any additional or closing comments.
I'd like to thank everyone for attending this, and I hope you got benefit out of it.
And again, thank you all for joining us for the final day of the IMS 13 Technical Education on Enhancements and Migration Planning Teleconference Series. The teleconference will be available in replay, and all registrants will receive an email when the files are posted with the link to those files. Again, thank you for joining us, and have a wonderful day.